You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Welcome to the Best of Flashpoints for the week of April 26, 2019. My name is Mike Biggs. Today on the program, we get an update on the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Also, the latest episode of the Election Crimes Bulletin with Greg Pallast. And later, we catch up with Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs for another installment of our regular series, Food Fight. All this straight ahead on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. First up on the show, we get an update on the ongoing battle to free political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. Listen to this.
This is Rachel Wolkenstein. I'm really pleased to be here on KPFA, and I want to let you know a little bit about Mumia Abu-Jamal's case, what's happening now, and my longtime work on this case. I began working with Mumia back in February 1987 when he contacted the Partisan Defense Committee, a legal defense organization I was working with. And at that time, we had learned actually from Ramona Africa that he was a Black Panther Party member who was on death row. We were not familiar with his case then. That was, I said, the beginning of 1987. And I first visited Mumia in August of that year. And in those intervening months, I had assisted him on various pro se legal challenges that he was making as a jailhouse lawyer regarding conditions in solitary confinement on death row and in a disciplinary block at SCI Huntington. So from 1987 through today, I continue to be a political advisor, legal advocate, and activist for Mumia. I began as officially co-counsel for him in 1995 and was co-counsel during the entirety of the post-conviction proceedings before the infamous Judge Albert Szabo. During that period of time, we had three evidentiary hearings, and it was at the height of, really, at that point, the fight against the first execution warrant, and we succeeded to get a stay of that execution warrant. Now, in that period of time, and I'll keep this as tight as I can, I was active also in helping to organize the first round of the international campaign to save Mumia Abu-Jamal's life. At that point in 87 and 88, when we launched this campaign, you have to understand and remember that Mumia was convicted in 82. The MOVE members that he had given support to and that were part of the reason why he was targeted had been, a lot of them were arrested for and falsely convicted of killing a police officer in 1978. And he was advocating for them when he got arrested. And just a few years later, the U.S. government and the Philadelphia Police Department did the firebombing of the MOVE home in May of 1985. And so the MOVE members who had been core to organizing for Mumia's defense during the trial were, a lot of them were in prison. They were killed. Some of them were underground. And it was a period of time when the few organizations from the American left that had supported Mumia and MOVE had really not been playing a forefront in the role. The Partisan Defense Committee, and I was staff counsel for it and also helped organize the first round of international protests in 1990, preceded by two rallies in Philadelphia in 89 and 90. Coming up in front in the face of the Fraternal Order of Police, referred to as the FOP, who argued that all Mumia's defenders at this July 14th, 1990 rally should be put on an execution couch. The people who spoke at that rally in defense of Mumia, and to make a link to what we're talking about now, the Philadelphia district attorney at that time, who was in the pay of the FOP being supported by them, was one Ronald Castile, So my work with Mumia began as assisting him in his fight for his freedom and to prevent him from being executed. In the course of that, I've become very good friends of Mumia's wife, his other family, and, of course, participating with other activists around the world to ensure to fight for Mumia's freedom.
Well, let me thank you for all that service. This is an incredibly important case, and people need to pay attention. Maybe we could start here in terms of current events. How is he doing?
Well, okay, that's very important. So Mumia just turned 65 yesterday, and as everyone, I believe, who's listening probably knows, that he's been in prison for over 37 years, over close to 30 of them in solitary confinement on death row. And for the past 9 years, he's been in, and sorry, 7 years, he's been in general population. And he is not well. You know, he's writing books. His second volume of his three-volume set of books called Murder Incorporated, which is about U.S. imperialism, has just been published. And this is, I think, his ninth or tenth book he's published since he's been in prison. So in that sense, and his commentaries that people hear regularly, one would think that he's all just, you know, fine. But he's not fine. Physically, he has really been debilitated. For the past 2.5 years from this very horrible skin ailment that he has, and it still continues to be very painful and itching pretty much around the clock. But more medically significant in terms of his life is the fact that he now has cirrhosis of the liver. You know, an international campaign helped win him the hepatitis C antiviral medication, which cured the hepatitis C, but not before he has suffered cirrhosis of the liver. That Hep C he got, by the way, from the drug, the blood transfusions he got on the night of December 9th, 1981, when he was shot by a police officer, beaten by the cops, critically wounded, and had surgery to repair that. And that is the only blood transfusion he's had in his life, and the source of, I believe, the hepatitis C that he had. And similarly, he was beaten very badly that night in his face as well. And it's now been recently determined that he has glaucoma and cataracts in both eyes, and the glaucoma is still progressing. It is getting some treatment, but he, last time I visited him just a couple of weeks ago, he could only read legal papers I brought for him by putting them within 2 inches of his eyes. So Mumia needs to get out of prison. I mean, he should have never been arrested to begin with. It was a total frame-up of an innocent man, but he is not well. He's 65 years old, and no matter how much you try to take care of yourself in the confines of prison through exercise, which he certainly does, that does not repair a body that's been damaged by the type of conditions that he's had to suffer in prison, and the combination of medical mistreatment as well as medical negligence. So this is a time more than ever that we need to renew the international protest campaign to win Mumia's freedom.
Okay, and now we don't have a ton of time, and I don't want to confuse people, but bring us up to speed. There were some victories, it's not close to a real victory, as you have often said. The victory is when he walks through the gates of perception, if you will, the prison gates, and is free. I'm looking forward. I've already arranged the date to bring him and Alice Walker on for an in-studio interview. We're ready.
We're all ready for that. We're all ready in our various ways to bring Mumia out of prison and home and like that. Okay, so here's where we're at right now. Actually, in the past couple of months, we've had wins. So they are very real wins, and here's what they are. In the end of December, December 27th, Mumia was granted new rights to appeal his conviction. And what this means is that all of the denials that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court issued of the against the evidence of Mumia's innocence and the police and prosecutorial and judicial misconduct behind his conviction and death sentence will now again be reappealed to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. This does not mean that Mumia has been granted a new trial or that Mumia is walking out of the door in the next couple of months. What this means is he gets an opportunity again to re-argue fundamental issues of his innocence and the frame-up and the denial of due process before a new panel, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. The other thing that happened is the current district attorney, the so-called progressive Larry Krasner, initially filed an appeal of Judge Tucker, that's the judge who granted Mumia new appeals, right, Judge Tucker's order, saying that this this decision based on fundamental due process in the appeal system should be fought and denied and overturned, and it was not justified. Now, after a barrage of international protest against Krasner, including raising the total hypocrisy in what he even says about being somebody who's a progressive DA, wants to end mass incarceration, there was a tremendous barrage of protest. And just a few days ago, on the 17th of, well, it's about a month ago now, on the 17th of March, Krasner withdrew his appeal of Judge Tucker's decision. At the same time, he made perfectly clear that his office was going to continue to fight against Mumia getting his conviction reversed, to get his charges dismissed, let alone allow him to have a new trial. Krasner made it clear that his withdrawal of the challenge to the process did not mean that he was agreeing in any way, shape, or form that Mumia was even entitled to a new trial. So that's really important for people to understand. The third thing that happened, which is a win, is that the district attorney's office, Krasner's office, disclosed the day after, a lot of this story I don't have time to go into, but is very suspicious, but the day after Judge Tucker granted his appeal, reinstating a new appeal rights for Mumia, Krasner announced that he had found in a hidden storage room, hidden files, six boxes of prosecution files on Mumia's case. And there were hundreds of other boxes similarly hidden in this storage room. These are boxes that were not at all part of the DA's system of recording, you know, case files about many different cases. There is absolutely every reason to believe by the description, limited description given by Krasner as to the content of these boxes, the fact that the evidence is under seal at this moment, that and the fact that they were hidden to begin with, that this is absolute confirmation of what we've been saying all along, that Mumia's conviction was based on suppression of evidence of his innocence and the manufacture of the evidence of his guilt. And this, in my mind, in the midst of this process, this path, legal path to Mumia's freedom that we have been fighting for, meaning the new appeals, the discovery of these boxes is actually the most explosive thing, in my very strong opinion, because in there is current confirmation of the cover-up of the frame-up of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Unfortunately, right now, for a variety of reasons, not totally clear to me, they are under seal, and that we are told that they are not going to be released until this entire appeal process that Mumia is now starting on again is concluded. That may very well take years. So, but this is a win. That they are sitting there is still a win, and we need to demand that they are open to the public and brought into court. So I do want to talk about, in the course of these wins, what our obstacles are, because the obstacles are the same obstacles we have faced for all these almost 40 years of fighting for Mumia's freedom. One is, in and of itself, the Fraternal Order of Police. Based upon my work investigating Mumia's case, I was in charge of the investigation during those hearings in from 95 to 99, which uncovered a lot of the evidence of showing the concretes of the manufacture of the false evidence against Mumia. I am convinced that in fact, what we need to understand is the police on the scene knew perfectly well that Mumia arrived after Faulkner, that's the police officer, was shot and killed. They knew that because they were there at the time. Our witnesses, defense witnesses, as well as the established that Mumia arrived after the shooting happened. Mumia's own affidavit states that he arrived after he went running to the scene when he heard, after he heard bullet shots in the distance. And in fact, the prosecution's evidence, so-called evidence, that Faulkner shot Mumia and Mumia shot him, is not supported by any evidence that the prosecution has presented. The ballistics evidence is contrary to that. The question of the scene, based upon both the photography taken by the police as well as an independent journalist, as well as the medical records concerning both Faulkner and Mumia, totally discount the entire prosecution scenario, including the fact that Mumia was in the midst or in the shooting. Mumia arrived afterwards. That is very important, which means that the police on the scene were part and parcel of creating a frame-up from the very beginning. So my point about all of this is that we have these pieces of information have ever opportunity of coming out, and part of the reason why I believe the Fraternal Order of Police has been the way it has been, in total not only opposition to Mumia's case, but engendered entire national opposition to Mumia that affected things that happened on the national stage, not only concerning Mumia's life in particular, but also on things such as President Obama's attempt to appoint somebody to be a deputy attorney general, but who was not allowed to do that, not voted for because he had been a attorney with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund while they were representing Mumia. So, and I will just share with you that I spoke a couple of times with Frank Serpico, with some of your older listeners are familiar with, a cop who actually broke the back of New York City police corruption and was almost killed by fellow police officers for that. And Serpico said to me, he said, look, I can't tell you whether I think Mumia is innocent or not. I don't know enough about the case. But I can tell you that the way the FOP has acted in terms of not only Mumia's case, but of supporters of Mumia nationally, means that there is police, direct police involvement in the shooting death of a police officer, Faulkner, and that is part of what is happening here. Now, that is in addition to, and I want to stress this too, in addition to the fact that Mumia was targeted by the FBI and the police from the time he was 15 years old. And in the time from he was 15 to the time that this shooting of Faulkner and Mumia being arrested for this, beaten for this, came to bear, was 10 years. And 10 years, as those of us who've gotten beyond the age of 40 know that goes a pretty quick period of time. And in those 10 years, Mumia was known in Philadelphia as a spokesman for the Black Panther Party, in the press as that, on the front pages of the Philadelphia Inquirer, the major press in Philadelphia. He spoke out against the shooting death of Panthers Hampton and Clark in Chicago that happened in 68, and Mumia went on to become a renowned radio journalist in Philadelphia, an outspoken supporter of the MOVE organization, and for all of these, he was in the gun sights of the Philadelphia police and the powers that be there. So he was targeted for political reasons. He was also framed up because of the death of this police officer that has not been resolved in any way that is truthful to and represents the actual facts of the case. There was a confession of one Arnold Beverly who said that he was hired to make this killing of the police officer because he was working with the FBI as part of an investigation into police and mob corruption at the time. Again, so that these things have not fully come out in court. They've been denied to be even heard in court. And what Mumia has an opportunity to do with these new appeals is to bring this evidence forward and also the evidence of fact of judicial misconduct. So one is the police, and they are right now gearing up. They had a meeting on Tuesday night in Philadelphia of some 500 former and current police officers and supporters demanding that Krasner be removed from office for refusing to proceed with this appeal. And they are going to be mobilizing nationally, and we need to be prepared and fight back for that. There's also the other question of the courts. The courts, there is no reason for anyone to assume, believe, expect that because Mumia is going before another panel of judges, that these judges are going to be fair and unbiased, particularly given the hot-button issues that Mumia's case brings up in every possible way and the notoriety of Mumia's case. They are politically elected. Judges in Pennsylvania are elected, and they are subjected to all those pressures of what it means to be directly elected. And right now we had a bit of a setback because it had looked like the Superior Court, which is the Intermediate Appeals Court, was going to send Mumia's case directly to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which is also elected, but it would mean that all nine judges would justices would deliberate, which allows for a majority one way or another amongst nine judges. But now it is going to the Superior Court, and the Superior Court is a panel of three judges, there is no direct absolute right that whatever those judges decide in Mumia's case will automatically be appealed to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. You have to request that. But equally important to that is the fact that the Superior Court decision and going through that process adds now years again to this entire appeal process. And time is not on our side, you know, given Mumia's age, the prison system, and also the fact that what is really, really necessary is reigniting, deepening, widening the political support for Mumia, the demands for his freedom, understanding that he has been prosecuted as part of a frame-up, that his case is rife with misconduct from every part of the criminal and justice system, the judiciary, the police, and the prosecution. And so what we have is so many issues in Mumia's case that are part and parcel of the fight against everything that's wrong with the American capitalist racist judicial system, criminal injustice system, and touches on questions of incarceration, mass incarceration, the way the courts work, the way the police work, et cetera. So we have to be very, very concerned about that, and what is necessary to be done is to not be lulled into thinking that we should simply celebrate at this point that we're on this path, legal path to Mumia's freedom. What is really necessary is mobilizing the forces that have the greatest ability to be able to shut down this system in a way that makes the powers that be that support Mumia, stop what they are doing, and that will be done by people understanding what Mumia's case means in every possible way and what it represents. And it also means understanding that the fight for Mumia is a fight for labor. It's a fight for blacks. It's a fight for working people. And it's a fight against really the worst the aspects of capitalism and all its racism, depredations, poverty, et cetera. And what we need is really a mobilization that encompasses not only civil rights organizations, you know, the Black Lives Matter, prison organizations, et cetera, but need to organize in the working class. And there was a very powerful demonstration in the West Coast in 1999 during the Millions for Mumia protests right before his second death warrant was signed. And to demand Mumia's freedom and for labor solidarity, in which the ILWU ports up and down the West Coast were closed for that day in solidarity with Mumia and demanding Mumia's freedom. Wow. And that type of labor action is necessary. When I first spoke about Mumia's case publicly in 1990, you know, way back then, made the point that what would difference it would make if, you know, Philly transit communication workers, as well as New York and whatever, understood that their fight for economic justice and for union rights involved defense of Mumia Abu-Jamal against the racist death penalty, against the criminal injustice system, and that Mumia walking out the door of prison would represent a step forward as part of the fight of all of us. All right.
Well, we're looking forward to that. We know that can happen. We are out of time, but I just, before we let you go, best place for people to get information, to follow, to be a part of in any way they choose. What's the best way to do that?
Well, the best way are several different things. In terms of the Philadelphia operation, is mobilization for Mumia. .org, and that's the number 4. I suggest people look at the Labor Action Committee to Free Mumia's website under Labor Action to Free Mumia. I have a lot of information that is historical as well as political on Mumia's case, and that's rachelwolkenstein.net. I do think that we really need in every place around the world renewed protest and organization and fight, being absolutely laser focused on the import of Mumia's case for our struggles worldwide and to free Mumia now.
Good job. We thank you for joining us on Flashpoints. It is good to have a thorough, expansive view for those who haven't heard much about it. Now they know a lot more. We thank you for joining us, and we will be keeping up this dialogue until, as I say, we interview Mumia here in our studio live. We're going to see that happen. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoints.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you so much to you and your viewership. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Listening to the best of Flashpoints for the week of April 26, 2019. My name is Mike Biggs.
Up next, we feature the latest episode of the Election Crimes Bulletin with best-selling author and investigative journalist Greg Palast.
We have been doing a multi-part, multi-year series in terms of fighting for your vote. We've been calling it the Election Crimes Bulletin because there are many crimes being committed against you. Now, Greg, let's come in. What does the census have to do with voting Chris Kobach and the next election? How about that?
Everything, and you will only hear it on the Election Crimes Bulletin. Yesterday, before the Supreme Court, the state of New York and other states challenged the Commerce Department's decision. That's your billionaire, doddering billionaire Wilbur Ross, Secretary Ross's decision to put the question of whether you or anyone in your household is or is not a citizen. Do you have a non-citizen in your household? And so the states are arguing that Ross went to his own experts in the Census Bureau, which is part of Commerce, and the Census Bureau told him, you add that question and you will lose 6.5 million voters from the constitutionally required census count, mostly Hispanics. And the result will be that six states will lose Congress people and the U.S. Congress because of the undercount of voters. California, New York, Illinois, Florida, Arizona, particularly all basically six blue congressmen will get the axe if they pull off this, if they add this question. Ross then, he said, well, he had no choice because the Justice Department told him it's something he had to do for some reason. It turns out on investigation that he told the Justice Department to send him a note ordering him to put this question on the census. Now, where did he get this idea? Because Wilbur Ross doesn't have many ideas these days of his own. It came from two people you may have heard of. We've talked about Chris Kobach of Kansas, and for short, we'll just say KKK. Chris Kobach of Kansas came up with this idea of citizenship question. And second, Chris Kobach, it was Steve Bannon, also told Ross, put that on the census, because they knew exactly what would happen. And you know, you have to understand, the census is, the main census never had this question for everyone. And the long form, as it's called, we asked some people, about 50 years ago, we were asking people this question on, a randomly selected group of citizens and people voting. Remember, the census is about counting people. It's not about counting citizens. This is very, very important. What does this have to do with voting? Chris Kobach, who called me and told me that this was his idea, by the way. Chris Kobach told me that and has said on Fox News, he's right up front, if people answer the census form and saying, I'm not a citizen, or people in my household are non-citizens, but they're registered to vote, aha, now we've got what he says are 2 million illegal aliens registered to vote. In fact, he said 1 million of those illegal alien registered voters voted for Hillary Clinton. 1 million. Now, by the way, he hasn't caught any. It's a federal crime. And if you show up to vote and your name's on the rolls and you got your address, it should be easy to find these people. He even said it should be easy to find these people. There's 1 million of these illegal voters, 2 million on the rolls. He hasn't found them. He says, here's how we'll find them, using the census. That is the ultimate trick. And what they're doing is, we've seen this before with this cross-check list, and with his prior alien voter hunts, what he will do is say, oh, there's a Jose Garcia in Florida. By the way, this is a real case. Jose Garcia in Florida. And there was a Jose Garcia who was deported. Must be the same Jose Garcia. Therefore, illegal voter, throw them off the voter rolls. But now they'll say, oh, Jose Garcia said, I am not a citizen. I'm just here on a green card. And then Jose Garcia, another Jose Garcia somewhere else is registered to vote. They'll say, aha, Jose Garcia, take him off the voter rolls. So we know the game that's being played.
Wow. Again, you're listening to Flashpoints. We're speaking with Greg Palast. He's the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And we've been working together for years now, trying to report on stories that put your vote in jeopardy. And the biggest story, and variations on a theme, is that this guy Kobach, this serial white supremacist, is back again and again. And it doesn't matter that he lost the election for governor. He's got some serious power here.
Well, in fact, one thing that seemed to pass over the heads of the lamestream media is that Trump's lawyer, the Solicitor General, said the reason we are doing this is to help enforce the Voting Rights Act. That should have sent off alarm bells. Instead, people laughed. Ha ha, you're using the Voting Rights Act as an excuse. That's not funny. Because what the Voting Rights Act and the National Voter Registration Act say is that the voter rolls must be accurate. Now, that would mean allowing every citizen to vote. That's what you and I think. But from their view, it's their excuse to go through the voter rolls using the census. Now, I know you're going to get 25 emails within the next 5 seconds saying, wait, but isn't the census private? There is something called Title 13 of the U.S. Code, which for decades has now said the census is private, that it can't be used by the FBI or anyone else. Well, guess what? USA Patriot Act, Section 215, according to a memo to Eric Holder, says indeed that the exception is national security. And if you are looking for the census records of non-U.S. persons, that's in the Patriot Act. The census is not safe when there are non-U.S. persons involved, and that is specifically anyone who marks, I'm not a citizen, but I'm living here, or I have non-citizens living here, as I do, by the way. I have two non-citizens living with me right now. But I'd have to answer on the census. They're not illegal or anything else. But what it's doing is scaring. It's also, they know it's going to scare away voters. And this is very, very dangerous stuff. So it's not according, and by the way, that information comes from the Electronic Privacy Information Center, the amicus brief they sent to the court, EPIC. And guess what? Who's used this exception before? A young radical right attorney in the Department of Homeland Security named Chris Kobach. It was Chris Kobach who came up with the Arab tracking, system for tracking Arab Americans using the census and also using other databases to track Arabs moving around the United States, Arabs and Muslim, under the USA Patriot Act. George Bush W. personally ordered that the Kobach Arab tracking system be shut down. How about that? We had to rely on W to protect our civil liberties from Kobach. Now Kobach has the ear. In fact, he's practically doing a lap dance with the president. Kobach was appointed by Trump to run his so-called voter fraud committee. They're very close. And in fact, if it weren't for Chris Kobach's voting shenanigans, Trump wouldn't be president. And he knows it. And this is the program for, basically, this is the kickoff of Trump's reelection campaign.
All right. Also, the kickoff is sort of the collapse of the Russiagate frenzy. And the sort of distraction that it created from the Clinton machine that was only interested in proving that the reason they lost to this ridiculous man named Donald Trump is because she was such a horrible candidate. So now what? Should they now be focused on? Are they serious? I guess the first action of the House was to think about voter security, but again, it was about Russia. It wasn't about the internal possibilities that we talk about when we talk about Chris Kobach and Trump and what they have in mind for the voter.
Well, I would like to remind you that the only reason Nancy Pelosi was reelected Speaker of the House was that she promised the insurgents and the young insurgents in the Democratic Party, that he would make voting rights issue number one in the House. In fact, they passed a bill, which they knew wouldn't go through the Senate, called H.R. 1, to protect voting rights. So after she did a little song and dance about voting rights to keep her job, it's been pretty much dropped. And they're back to still trying to figure out what they can do with the Mueller report, obstruction of justice, et cetera. You know, I mean, I don't make light of these things, but when we talk about how the election was manipulated, it wasn't from Moscow. How many times do we have to say this? And, you know, and it's not a few Facebook ads. There was, you know, 100,000 Facebook ads or something in that area, or even less. That's the extreme amount. And most of that, by the way, done after the election. That's nothing in a campaign where over $2 billion was spent, most of it by Hillary Clinton. It was about suppressing the vote. We had using just Kris Kobach's cross-check system when I was did the investigation for Rolling Stone, and I put together a whole team of statisticians. It was 1.1 million voters. It concentrated in places like Ohio, Michigan, which Trump supposedly won by 10,700 votes, Georgia, North Carolina, and we see the effects of these vote suppression systems created by Kobach, in the supposed loss of Stacey Abrams in Georgia, and you know who is the one candidate, the only major Democratic Party candidate, who has said, "I'm conceding that I'm not governor, but I didn't lose the election." She specifically last week cited my calculation that 340,134 Georgians were illegally and wrongly removed from the voter rolls, and that was by a scheme created by Kris Kobach of Kansas for his buddy Brian Kemp of Georgia. This is dangerous stuff, because once they have the census, one, not just scaring away people, but access to the census, this is dangerous, dangerous. I would note that that Tom Hartman, because he's afraid that people will be scared from filling out their census form, don't do that. That's like saying, oh, they're going to steal my vote, so I'm not going to register to vote. No, we need everyone to fill out the census form. Don't answer the citizenship question. If no one answers, it becomes worthless to them.
Right.
And
that's,
you know,
right.
I usually don't. I don't endorse candidates, but I can endorse a civil liberties action. And that is, don't answer that question. Don't.
You know, I also, in the context of covering elections, the corporate press has a lot of responsibility. I mean, they essentially, the corporate executives at MSNBC and CNN bragged about how much money they made on Trump, building him up and taking him down. There was some estimate, very reliable, I'm not sure if it came out of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting or whatever, that Trump got, when you added it all together, 50 times more coverage, Trump and his family, than all the other Republican candidates. 50 times more. How does that compare to a few ads on Facebook?
And in addition, I mean, Hillary Clinton did spend well over $1 billion on ads. $1 billion. I mean, see, she can't say that it was a couple Facebook ads. I mean, look, if there's no question that, and Putin has said that he preferred Donald Trump, who said, he'd like to reset the relationship with Russia. We have a lot of nations which kind of stuck their little fingers into the election, from China to Israel to Saudi Arabia. We know that. But in the end, what really made the difference, and we can calculate it name by name, is the removal of voters of color from the voter rolls in particular, and the blockading of the count of the vote. And this new gimmick is not being understood as a way to reach into the voter rolls and another way to remove voters, even if things like where Kobach is saying, even if they can't reach into those voter rolls, into the census directly, into a direct comparison with the voter rolls, but clearly they can. I mean, even Eric Holder has said they can, okay? The you know, the Attorney General under Obama. But even beyond that, they can still get that supposed phony information showing, oh, look at all these non-Americans, and yet there's all these people clearly with names that match those who are registered to vote. And it's going to be like a kind of electoral pogrom. And this is not, the voting aspect is not being discussed, even though it was interestingly, like I said, Trump's own lawyer who brought it up and said the reason for doing this is to protect the voter rolls. No one asked what do you mean by that? You know, it's like what he means by that is something, is a new form of electronic fascism and racism. And it's the new, it's Jim Crow in cyberspace. This is what we have to worry about right now. And so I'm very concerned. And again, don't let this stop you from filling out the census form, because then they win by reducing your voting power, the number of Congress people you have, the number, how you divide state, Senate, and assembly districts, how you, the electoral votes of the states are affected by this. You lose a congressman, you lose an electoral vote, by the way. Okay? I'm sure Trump doesn't mind California losing two electoral votes. So this is very, very dangerous stuff. So please do fill out the census form. Don't answer the question about citizen.
All right.
Just don't.
Okay. That's Greg Palast. He can be reached and followed at gregpalast.com. He is the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. That's a book and a film. Reports for the BBC in the United States, Rolling Stone, and does a great deal of important work in terms of protecting your election, your vote. And we're going to continue our dialogue all the way through 2020. And there's going to be a lot to talk about as we watch this unfold. Greg, thank you.
You're very welcome, Dennis.
You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Finally, we close today's show with the latest installment of our regular new series, Food Fight, with Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs.
In Berkeley, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we continue with our regular weekly segment, Food Fight, with Food Not Bombs founder Keith McHenry. He joins us from Santa Cruz. Keith, last we spoke, you were working with the homeless. There was a major lawsuit. Could you remind people about the lawsuit and some of the fallout and other things that are happening around that in this struggle for the homeless to be fed and to have a place to live that's not illegal because it's outside?
Yes. So there is a camp behind Gateway Plaza in Ross that's now expanded to way over 200 people. And the city is trying to figure out how to get rid of that camp and drive those people away. So there is a Martin v. Boise case that says it is cruel and unusual punishment to be breaking down camps without providing alternative living spaces for the people living there. And this is a struggle that's now happening all over, particularly the Western United States, in regards to this Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals case. And so we were able to get a group of homeless people that live in the camp to do their own federal lawsuit to stop the eviction. And so the city has kind of ignored that. Even they talk about an ACLU letter that is telling them it will be illegal to drive the people out of the camp without providing housing or shelter space. And there is no shelter space. But the most unusual thing is to have the Santa Cruz Union of the Homeless and the Ross Camp Homeless Council do their own lawsuit and get it into federal court. And that seems to have freaked out the city completely. So they then came up with another scheme, which is to call it a health emergency. And they went before a judge yesterday to get a ruling that people can be kicked out of Ross Camp after on Wednesday at 4 o'clock if they don't willingly leave to another camp that they have set up, which will last between 5 and 7 days in the Benchlands, which is across from the county courthouse. And so, oddly enough, they're offering a free flame-resistant tent to every person who moves to that camp. They're actually giving out vouchers. You have to prove you lived in Ross Camp to get into the new camp. And they get platforms, a sleeping bag, and a new tent, something they could have done 20 years ago, but which, of course, they are doing now just as a public relations thing. And then that judge, this Superior Court judge here in Santa Cruz, ruled that they can drive people out starting at 4 o'clock on Wednesday. So then we, this morning, were able to get a hearing on Friday in federal court to block that eviction. And that's to be heard Friday at 9 o'clock in Judge Davila's courtroom in the federal court in San Jose. And so this drama is quite the drama now. And we are outside of city council currently because one of the progressive city councilors, Justin Cummings, introduced legislation locally to get rid of the homeless out of Ross Camp and essentially out of town. And we stayed up till about 10 o'clock last night meeting with him, trying to convince him to not vote on his own proposal because he was supposed to be one of the four progressive city councilors. So this is quite a drama that is happening. And essentially what will happen if the city succeeds and we fail at our temporary restraining order in federal court and we fail in our, in ultimately blocking this, there will be hundreds of more people, at least 200 more people, probably wandering the streets of Santa Cruz, moving into already crowded doorways. Now, and this drama is everywhere in, like I say, all across the country, but mostly in the western states.
It was interesting what you said, that the city there was willing to give the equipment, tent, waterproof tent, and a sleeping platform to get the people to move, but they won't do anything to accommodate the struggle and the growing need for low-income housing and food for the homeless, the folks who are now really more and more in the streets. And it's not just individuals, it's families. Now it's mostly women we're seeing in the street. It's really a slap in the face that they would try and move people with a little, you know, a little crumb, ultimately to get rid of them.
Yeah, it's well, one of our arguments is we have depositions from homeless women that were sexually assaulted while living in doorways in Santa Cruz. And I find that that happens very frequently. People come to me and they say they were assaulted. Is there a shelter? You know, they sometimes think there might be a battered women's shelter or something that exists, but none of these things exist. So we actually started a process in this lawsuit of calling all the shelters to see if they have space. And so far, and these are legal declarations by people living in the streets where they cannot find a place. And this is very, very common. And now we are starting to create a record that basically you can call or can try to get into all the so-called adequate shelters. So the thing is that there's at least 800 people living outside in the city limits. Some estimate it could be like 1,000 or more. And they are offering roughly 100 beds in one shelter. But to qualify is virtually impossible. People actually have to wait sometimes months to get into that shelter. They shut the emergency shelter down almost 4 years ago, I believe. And they stopped the daily meal at the homeless service center at the same time they shut that shelter down. And then we get reports there's the winter shelter, which they always tell us, and the fact they've even sent us a photo showing that there was no room there. And that's people living, sleeping shoulder to shoulder on gym mats. It crowded us like sardines in this small little space at the Veterans of Foreign War. It's run by the Salvation Army, as is a second family type shelter, which is already to capacity too. And so there's you know, less than 200 spaces total, and yet they're claiming that if they make this one camp, which will have space for maybe 60 people to up to 100, which they will close in June, that they have now complied with Boise versus Martin v. Boise, which is actually not the case. And so we think we have a very strong case in federal court. And we are hoping that homeless people across the country start organizing their own unions of the homeless and start studying, like, our videos and everything on foodnotbombs.net to find out how they can do their own federal lawsuit.
Well, so, one thing you said, Keith, that I was concerned about there, you're saying that there's no place for women who are now being attacked. More and more women are homeless who are now under attack, that there is no battered women's shelter. There's no capacity to deal with this, you know, upsurge in attack on women who now find themselves more and more find themselves homeless.
Yeah, there is not none. In fact, a huge percentage of this Ross camp are women, and mostly in their like 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. It's become the location of safety for women on the streets. And they're going, and imagine the tension of being told that the police are going to come in tomorrow at 4 and start taking all your belongings and everything. And then you're going to stay for 5 days at this other temporary camp with your brand new sleeping bag, tent, and platform. And then you're going to, if you are lucky, get into this other camp, which that is behind a barbed wire fence and a kind of a stockade. It looks more like a minimum security prison. It's has a police station at it, and you can only come and go with a van, and no friends can come in and meet you there. And that is what's going to, that is the alleged solution. And yet on in the middle of the summer, those people will be joining everybody else in the doorways. So this is, really inhumane. Okay. We're one of the wealthiest communities in the world, and yet, and this exact scenario, well, this is like an escalation of it, but for 30 years that I've been coming to Santa Cruz to speak about the homeless crisis, like when I was an activist in San Francisco, I came down here often to speak to city council, encourage them to build SROs, single room occupancy hotels, and other solutions, claiming that the homeless crisis would get larger and larger, and it has, and it will. I mean, the global economic tensions, you know, just imagine gas prices are going way up. No one's getting tax refunds. You know, the economy is like for working people and poor people is in collapse.
All right. Well, I got to jump in here because we're out of time. But what comes next? We just have 30 seconds.
There's going to be the hearing between now and the federal hearing on Friday. We don't know if the city's going to violate the spirit of the law and just send in riot police to drive everyone out tomorrow at 4, or if they're going to actually, you know, what they should do, which is to wait for the temporary restraining order to be either lost or won on Friday. And that's where it's at now. If people can learn more about this at foodnotbombs.net. And if you're listening to this and you live on the streets and you're looking for food anywhere in the world, we're in 65 countries, have meals in 1,000 cities, they can reach me at 1-800-884-1136. And then we'll be celebrating our 39th anniversary of Food Not Bombs on Friday, May 24th. And we have, for instance, a concert in Santa Cruz at the Research Center for Nonviolence. But there'll be events all over the world on that weekend to celebrate our 39th anniversary.
Okay, that's the voice of Keith McHenry. He's the founder of Food Not Bombs. And this is our regular weekly segment called Food Fight, in which we try and highlight the battle, the fight that poor people and hungry people have to eat in this country. Thanks so much, Keith. Talk to you next week.
Yeah, thank you so much, Dennis. Take care. Bye-bye.
That does it for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Kevin Pina and Miguel Gavilan Molina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, climate scientist James G. Anderson. And not all of the news is bad. I hope you'll stay tuned. In a few weeks, New World Notes will be 8 years old. I'm as surprised as anybody at our endurance. One thing that's helped considerably is my discovery that I am far from alone in this. By this, I mean producing audio programs and giving them away in the attempt to make some small difference in the world. Over the years, I've found a handful of people who have been recording high-quality, thoughtful speeches and interviews with a progressive perspective, like my own. The producers have shared these recordings, and some of them have ended up broadcast on New World Notes, perhaps with a bit of editing and condensing by yours truly. That includes this week's program, part one of an interview with climate scientist James G. Anderson. Now, there are some fine established producers that have made big contributions to alternative radio. For instance, David Barsamian, Mariah Gillardin, Alex Smith, and Lynn Gary, now retired. These are my role models, so to speak. But I'd like to single out some people who are much less well-known. Little guys, so to speak, out in the field, doing very good work, pro bono. That list includes Robin Upton, who took over unwelcome guests when Lynn Gary retired. Robin lives in Bangladesh, of all places. A little closer to home, in Seattle, are Ed Mays and also Mike McCormick. In Boston, Chuck Rosina has recorded many fine talks and the occasional concert. In upstate New York, Wilton Vaught has made very good recordings for local public access TV. From time to time, New World Notes has adapted and broadcast material recorded and shared by all of these people. Many thanks to them, and to one more, Dale Lehman in Chicago, who interviewed climate scientist James G. Anderson. Anderson works at Harvard, but found himself in Chicago about a year ago. Dale was quick to pounce and got a very interesting interview. We'll hear it this week and next. In this week's segment, Anderson explains why global warming is a bad term. For one, it radically understates the climate change calamity that is now underway. He then makes short work of the trumped-up argument that climate change is natural, not man-made. He has interesting things to say also about the ozone layer, the Kyoto Protocol, and why electricity is overwhelmingly the best fuel. Best for transportation, and surprisingly, best for heating, too. It's fascinating stuff. Anderson is a model of clarity, and obviously a pretty knowledgeable guy. Speaking with Dale Lehman, here is James G. Anderson.
I'd like to ask, how would you define climate change?
How would I define climate change?
Yeah.
Well, I think the most important way to look at climate change is to look at the structure that defines the overall dynamics of the atmosphere and how that couples into a combination of weather, severe storms, changes in the ice structures, shifts in the temperature difference between the tropics and the polar regions. So the climate is set up as a feedback structure that is highly coupled, so that changes in one part, for example, loss of Arctic ice, cascades into a whole array of different fundamental changes in the structure of climate. For example, right now the current climate structure is built around a very cold polar region and a very warm tropics, and because of that, we have a very, very dry stratosphere, and that's a unique climate structure. If we lose Arctic ice and the temperature difference starts to decrease between the tropics and the polar regions, the overturning structure of the atmosphere will relax, and water will enter the stratosphere. We'll have a very wet stratosphere, and the result of that is that the temperature difference between the equator and the pole will essentially vanish. And that completely changes the way the climate structure of the Earth behaves. But more than that, with a moist stratosphere, ozone is removed from the stratosphere because we have chlorine and bromine that are present there because of CFC release. And so that's going to be profoundly damaging to life on the surface, not just human beings, but also all of our staple crops that provide food for the population. All of that will collapse. So I view climate as an issue of the structure, not simply a matter of global warming. I think that term global warming is a very inappropriate description. It carries with it the connotation of very slow change and the fact that we can think things over. But instead of that, climate is a series of irreversible steps. The time constant for change is set by these feedbacks. And so it's a very delicate, very intricate structure that we've been bequeathed by the optimal relationship between the cold polar region and the warm tropics.
We've always had these debates, right, regarding climate change is caused by humans or is it caused by nature, but where do you stand on this matter?
Well, when you look at the changes in climate over the past millions of years, it's very evident that there were mechanisms in place that caused those natural changes, whether it was a volcanic emission of CO2, whether it was the removal of CO2 from the atmosphere by the carbonate silicate reactions, or whether it was the Earth's orbit eccentricity and the tilt of the Earth in combination that carried us in and out of glacial periods for the past 2.5 million years. When you look at these patterns, they are all overwhelmed by increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It's a very simple calculation. And so the idea that what we've seen recently is a natural process decoupled from human activity is simply false. Humans are overwhelmingly responsible for causing the forcing of the climate that's now taking place, that slowly manifests itself in average global temperature change, but dramatically emphasizes the point that the delicacy of the climate structure revolves first around the removal of ice structures, particularly in the Arctic, And so there's no question that human beings are fundamentally responsible for the current changes in the climate.
Do you think climate change is drastically affecting you?
Well, it's drastically affecting me in that I study it, and my concern grows year by year as I study the system more and more carefully and study the feedbacks that lead to tipping points, which are irreversible changes. So it has a huge impact on my life. With respect to my analysis of personal impacts by climate change alone, part of our research focuses on the intensity and frequency of severe storms in the high plains of the United States in the summer. These are tornadoes, hail storms that we tend to take for granted in this country, but are in fact unique worldwide. And the reason that these storms are important, first of all, is of course they are profoundly destructive to human life and human property. But more importantly, they're capable of injecting water directly into the stratosphere over the United States in the summer. And we diagnosed the chemistry over the Antarctic and the Arctic in the winter that led to the Antarctic ozone hole and then comparable large removal of ozone over the Arctic in the late winter. And diagnosing that chemistry, we realized that it's exactly the same chemistry that's triggered by storms injecting water vapor into the stratosphere, except in this case it's over the United States in the summer rather than the polar regions in the winter. So, absolutely. Now, of course, the jet stream position is a sensitive function of the temperature difference between the tropics and the polar regions. And that jet stream position, of course, brought one of the largest snowfalls to New England. So, yeah, I shoveled out day after day after day. And if we had a disciplined temperature structure between the tropics and the polar regions, the meandering of that jet stream would not have occurred the way it did. So, yes.
We know that many institutions these days spend so much money on trying to combat global warming. There are many non-profit organizations, but do you think the money being spent is actually making a difference? Because we see that global warming is still a very big issue.
Okay, first of all, of course, based on what I've said so far, the term global warming is an inappropriate term to describe climate change. And I think one of the reasons that the entire campaign around climate change has been ineffective was that, and scientists are at fault for this, the term global warming was used, and it carries with it no political imperative, because many people want their backyard to be warmer. They're moving out of New England and the northern Midwest and moving south. So it has no political impetus behind it, and it has this connotation of slow change. So if I compare the resources going into describing climate change and its irreversible consequences versus the money that's going in from the fossil fuel industry distributing misinformation about this subject, there's no parity between those two. Massively more money is being spent on misinformation from the fossil fuel industry than is being spent on representing the facts related to climate change. Now, I also hold universities culpable because they're not educating their undergraduates on the fundamentals of what's actually occurring in the climate energy axis. And until universities step up and take responsibility for modern curricula that prepare their graduates to take a proactive role in society, it's going to be very difficult to make political progress, because the money invested in by the fossil fuel industry and misinformation largely overwhelms efforts to try to explain this to the public.
Do you think climate change is now more to a political issue or a scientific issue?
Yeah, well, it's overwhelmingly an issue of political will, but you're absolutely correct in bringing in three elements of this: politics, science, and economics. And as the situation is examined more and more carefully, it's pretty clear that economics is switching strongly over for renewable energy because, to put it bluntly, middle-aged and older people are making money off of fossil fuels, and that blocks opportunity for young people to engage in innovation, creativity, and economic enterprise globally. But the investment in renewables and the job opportunities presented by renewable energy vastly overwhelm the job opportunities in fossil fuels. And in fact, you can see it occurring. There are major investments by companies. Google, for example, is just one, but many others, investing in renewable energy and renewable energy infrastructure. And the country that wins this battle on innovation and development of renewable energy sources, wind, solar, geothermal, that become economically competitive worldwide will be the country or countries that win the economic battle, because there's vastly greater opportunity and capability for the next generation embedded in the renewable energy sector than there is in fossil fuels. Fossil fuels is a dead industry. It doesn't generate jobs in anything close to the number of the potential within the renewable energy industry.
Are you familiar with the Kyoto Protocol?
Oh, yes.
Do you think it would actually be beneficial for the U.S. if it actually joined the Kyoto Protocol? Because it did withdraw from the Kyoto Protocol, right?
Right. Well, starting with another protocol, we did the key research over the Antarctic demonstrating that CFCs destroyed ozone, in particular the chlorine and bromine radicals. And so we were involved in the public policy debates around the Montreal Protocol, which then became an international agreement banning CFCs. So I've watched the evolution of these protocols very carefully. The Kyoto Protocol had on its side the advantage that it brought nations together to try to execute an international agreement on fossil fuels. Now, it failed in many ways. One of them was that it probably didn't recognize the rapid ascent of the Asian economic structure. And secondly, you can watch very carefully to see whether there'll be any serious negotiation over carbon release, meaning CO2 and methane, by whether nations actually have a highly unequivocal budget of their own carbon release and take up, because all of these countries are very, very different. The United States, for example, because it was an agricultural endeavor on the eastern end of the United States in the 19th and early 20th century, it actually was taking up quite a bit of carbon because it was regrowing these forests that were cleared for farming. But every nation is different, and every nation has to have a very detailed definition of the flux of carbon into and out of its own territory. So the Kyoto Protocol didn't have that basic information in place, so it couldn't in any way be an effective international governance. On the other hand, it opened the debate about nations signing on to carbon control. So from that point of view, it was a landmark event. It just had some fatal flaws in it, which could have been repaired in time had countries stepped in to take advantage of it. And that gets back to the fundamental point. Until China, the United States, Western Europe, Japan, and Korea, and perhaps Brazil, sign on to a carbon control agreement, it won't take place. So, you know, meetings involving 190 nations are simply never going to solve the problem. It has to be solved with China and the United States signing an agreement, having clear controls, and then Western Europe, Korea, and Japan signing on to those agreements.
There has been theories regarding why climate change has happened. For example, like that there's a change in the ozone layer. Do you think that it really a big factor, the change in the ozone layer in terms of how the climate is changing?
no, the ozone layer doesn't control climate. Climate controls the ozone layer. Works the other way around. Ozone controls this lethal small segment of the spectrum, the ultraviolet spectrum, which just barely penetrates the stratospheric ozone, because ozone is the only molecule that removes ultraviolet photons between 200 and 300 nanometers, which is exactly where DNA absorbs ultraviolet photons. And an ultraviolet photon absorbed by DNA breaks the base pair across the double helix and it initiates cancer. So ozone is extremely rare. If you compress the total ozone column from the stratosphere to the floor of this office, it would only be an eighth of an inch thick. So tiny, tiny amount of ozone. It has dominant control, total control over that crucial segment of the ultraviolet spectrum that kills organisms on the surface and initiates cancer. But ozone doesn't control the climate. On the other hand, climate intimately controls ozone, because climate controls the amount of water going into the stratosphere, and the amount of water in the stratosphere that decidedly controls the ozone concentration.
Why do you think humans have failed to actually, like, curb the greenhouse gases, to control them?
Oh, because the entire economic infrastructure is built on the back of cheap energy, namely fossil fuels. And fossil fuels are abundant, they're very inexpensive, and yet they are responsible for 85% of all primary energy generation worldwide. So we've built fossil fuels into our economic structure. However, I think Mother Nature is sitting back and watching this process, saying, well, I gave humans the intelligence to know how to extract an amount of fossil fuels to initiate the Industrial Revolution, but I've also given human beings 10,000 times as much energy per unit time from the sun as is required to sustain all of human endeavor. So now I'm going to see whether humans are smart enough to convert from fossil fuel to renewable energy, because I've given them all the renewable energy they could possibly hope for. And so it's going to be a question of political will and fundamental intelligence about whether we can break the back of a needless economic infrastructure based on fossil fuels that not only causes climate change, but the release of nitrate, sulfate, heavy metal from coal combustion in particular is extremely toxic. I mean, look at China today. Look at the United States 30 years ago. Nitrate sulfate emission is a catastrophic contribution to acidity in the atmosphere and damages lakes, human lungs, and then mercury that's interstitial to coal is very damaging to the human nervous system. So everything is wrong with burning fossil fuels. Everything is correct in converting photons from the sun to electricity. And that leaves you with only 7% of the requirement for liquid fuels, and we can create all the liquid fuel we need for aviation from biomass. So nature set this whole system up ideally for us. The question is, are we smart enough to figure this out?
Do you think that humans can switch to renewable energy in the near future, though? Because people do have some technology, such as solar-powered cars, but the when they do try to invent that, they later on found out that it would quite be costly to be used in the near future.
Automobiles, are you talking about?
For example, automobiles, yeah.
Okay, let's take an automobile. I drive an electric car, for example, and the first thing you discover when you drive an electric car is that they're profoundly better systems than a gasoline-powered automobile. They are quiet, they accelerate very, very quickly. They're very agile. They're very simple to drive. And it costs you, typically for a standard gasoline powered car, it costs you about $2,500 a year for the average driving distance to fuel that car for a year. It costs you $250 for the electricity to go the same distance. So immediately, if if humans test electric cars, they're going to switch over to them. Now, it's true the technology for the range of the electric car is evolving. The Tesla Model S, for example, goes 280 miles on a charge. The particular car I drive goes about 100 miles on a charge, but it has a range extender for another 80 miles or so. So the cost is actually far less to propel the system through electricity than it is through buying gasoline. And the same is true of heating and cooling buildings. A heat pump is more than twice as efficient as burning fossil fuels in your basement to heat your house, because the heat pump uses the intrinsic heat or energy in an air mass and only adds a small amount of that to warm your house. And this can be done thermodynamically very, very efficiently. So when you look at the laws of thermodynamics, you see that electricity, heat pumps, electric motors are vastly more efficient and less expensive than heat engines. Heat engines, for example, in your car only convert about 12 to 13% of the chemical energy in gasoline into motive force. So if you look at the laws of physics and you look at the economic pathways forward, you see the electrification of these systems is by far the most efficient, cost-effective way. And that doesn't include all the damage done to the environment and to climate by the effluents coming from fossil fuel combustion.
1, 2, 3, 4. First you have to have a problem. That part isn't hard. The second step is everybody realizing they're like you. They're holding the same card. Step three is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change. So quick. The congressmen and businessmen and TV sets will try hard to make sure it isn't so. You don't have a problem. If you do, it's not the same problem. And if it is, well, there's just nowhere you can go but tap. Many times the history is rich, though we easily forget how a meme can take hold and grab you, how it can spread out like a net, and everything can change. So they'll say we are lost or we're dreaming, or they'll make a dream for us. They'll try to come up with a good story about why we belong at the back of the bus, about why we belong in this position, about how we don't know what we meant, about how there most certainly isn't any such thing as the 99%, but everything can change. Everything can change so quick.
We followed James Anderson's mildly optimistic talk with a mildly optimistic song by David Rovix. Thanks to both, and thanks to Dale Lehman for the recording, which I have gently edited. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. You'll find a free archive of our shows on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire staff, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non carborundum, try to live each day as though the truth were true, and please come back again for part two of the Anderson interview and more next week. Ciao.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
I'm joined on the show today by Andrew Craig, who's a lawyer and was a former journalist for the Hartford Courant. He's an author of two books, one that came out in the 80s called Spiked, and more recently, Presidential Puppetry. He currently lives in the belly of the beast, Washington, D.C., and has a very informative website, which is at www.justice-integrity.org, where you can find out more information about what we're going to be talking about today and a lot of other breaking news stories. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Oh, so good to talk to you again, Cheryl.
Yes. Is there anything you'd like to add that I may have left out?
Well, add one thing. Just today, as we're talking, the Washington Post quoted me in its story about the Mueller probe and the Roger Stone and other hearings, and cited website. I'd run into a reporter at a Roger Stone hearing. Roger Stone is from Connecticut, of course, as well as Paul Manafort. So we try to keep vigilant here on the news and talk to the reporters and talk to really everybody with a bit of a historical context.
Yeah, that's what I love about your website, is that you have all the latest up to date. You go to all these meetings because you're right there in Washington, and so it's very informative. So let me just get to what we're talking about today. You are part of a recently formed group called the Truth and Reconciliation Committee. Could you tell us what this group's mission is and more about it and who's on it and why it all matters?
Well, the mission is to bring truth and reconciliation to the country via understanding better the four major political assassinations of the 1960s. These were of President Kennedy, Malcolm X, of Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. And in all four of those situations, significant evidence has come to light to either undermine the official story of the assassinations and or to show that there are some sinister political aspects to them that affect modern politics. And so in January, shortly before the Martin Luther King national holiday, about 60 of us announced a goal to urge Congress, persuade the public, to urge Congress to reinvestigate these four major assassinations. And the group that did this consists perhaps most notably of family members of all four of the victims of the assassinations, plus various expert medical doctors, scientists, lawyers, and authors, and researchers, and celebrities. And among the celebrities, I know you have a serious audience, but I'll just say that part of the news coverage of this noted that the celebrities included film stars like Alec Baldwin, Martin Sheen, and some others. So various people are coming together to try to understand our past, not to prosecute anybody, but just to understand it for a better understanding of what's going on today, that we don't have as much time or ability to research, but may be equally mysterious in various ways.
And why do you think this is important? Why do you put a lot of your time and energy into this? Why would this matter?
Well, all over the world, including in the United States, we have current affairs that are extremely important to all of our lives, and yet we have only a partial view or partial understanding of what's really going on. So, for example, at the beginning of the show, I mentioned that I cover things like the Paul Manafort or Roger Stone criminal cases here in Washington. These are all part of the Robert Mueller special prosecutor's investigation of the Trump administration. And what the Washington Post published today in the interview quoting me is, I said, part of the public thinks that the Mueller investigation is the ultimate in good government against bad government and bad people. But another part of the public thinks that it's a coup d'etat. It's an attempt to overthrow the elected President Trump. And yet, Cheryl, realistically, we have only a partial view of what the FBI has been doing so far. We do see indictments. We do see these kind of hearings. But a much fuller perspective of what might be forthcoming comes from a historical inquiry into what types of things the FBI has done in the past, not just in the 60s, but during the suppression of documents leading right up to the present concerning events in the 60s and elsewhere. So if we understand, for example, the most important of the 3,500 books about the JFK assassination, that provides important lessons for very, very current affairs that some of us are engaged in right now.
And I see that on your website, which is if people want to go to help out or sign the petition calling for this reinvestigation of these assassinations, the website is americantruthnow.org. And I see in there that this group of 60 of you are calling for Congress to oversee the release of all these documents to the JFK assassination that I think were supposed to be released by 2017 and haven't been.
Right. In 1992, both houses of Congress passed unanimously something referred to by its nickname, the JFK Records Act, and it set up a process, and basically all relevant records were supposed to be released by 2017 in the fall, with very narrow exceptions. And President Trump only released some of the remaining documents. And then he asked for a postponement until last spring, and then he released some more. But it was a very haphazard process that was clouded in mystery, just like the original Warren Report in 1964, which had no index. And so some of the documents that were released in 2017, 2018, had already been released with different redactions. And it was enormously confusing to reporters, and I was one, as well as to the regular public. And it added to the sense that no one will ever know what happened. Let's just go on with our lives and forget about it, more or less, except maybe on anniversaries. But that can't be the solution to something that is so important. The president was murdered in broad daylight, and the public was not told the facts, and a cover-up has existed until the present. And we can't take seriously discussions about law and order, the free press, transparency, democracy, unless there's a normal accounting, a normal news coverage. You mentioned earlier that I'd worked at the Hartford Courant. I worked there 14 years, doing everything from town coverage to feature articles, but most relevantly to this is I covered federal courts for 5 years. And so we would put enormous effort into researching a story and writing it. But I can tell you, Cheryl, that very few of us, and certainly not me, had any idea while we were covering bank robbery trials or all kinds of other matters that the four major assassinations were highly dubious what the official records were. And later in life here in Washington, I learned that, and I've talked to scores of relevant people involved. And the Warren Report, for example, just is not true. It's a cover-up job. It's partial truth. And the same thing is true about Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy's death. In fact, just earlier this morning, I was on the phone with Dr. William Pepper, who's a friend of both of those individuals. And let me share what that friendship led to. He became convinced, so convinced, that their accused killers were innocent, that this friend of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy ended up as defense attorney for their accused killers, Sirhan Sirhan and James Earl Ray. And he was convinced, as a human rights advocate, as an attorney, as a friend of the slain people, that they were absolutely innocent, not just on technicalities, but they could not possibly have fired the bullets that killed his friends. And he's not alone. There are scientists who have signed these petitions who feel the same way. Now, I hasten to point out that Sirhan Sirhan did fire bullets in the Ambassador Hotel in 1968. And they were aimed towards Robert Kennedy. And one, in fact, hit a friend of Robert Kennedy, Paul Schrade, who was standing next to the senator who was running for president. But the fatal bullets came from the rear, according to the coroner's report. And very few people know that. The coroner, Dr. Thomas Noguchi, is still alive. He's in his 90s. And I'll just maybe end on this note, Cheryl, to say this is the type of evidence that the American public need to know to understand both why the four most important progressive leaders of the 1960s died, but also what the implications are today. It's not just an abstract interest in justice, an armchair exercise. But when you're talking about the progressive agenda, you're talking about the economic safety net. You're talking about jobs and opportunity and education and health care and everything that makes up for modern life, including tax cuts for the rich and lower refunds and higher taxes for everybody else.
Right. It was government for the people instead of what we have, government for corporations and the powerful right now.
As long as I'm doing this kind of checklist, I got to throw in one other aspect.
Sure.
War. I mean, we're on the verge of starting a new war down in Venezuela right now. And the whole U.S. aid to Venezuela is an obvious hoax. I mean, if we wanted to give aid to Venezuela, we wouldn't be starving the people with sanctions.
Right, right.
And so John Kennedy wanted to stop the Vietnam War. And Martin Luther King, his fatal mistake was advocating for the end of the Vietnam War 5 years later. And Robert Kennedy, the same thing in 1968. They wanted to stop the wars and focus on the American people. And more convoluted story of how that led to their death than I can do in a bullet point. But I just wanted to tee up the war aspect of this.
Now, and isn't Paul Schrade the guy who was with Robert Kennedy when he got shot? Isn't he one of the 60 signatories on your petition?
Yeah.
So even he says that Sirhan didn't do it.
Well, not only does he say it, but he's a passionate believer in Sirhan Sirhan's innocence. Sirhan Sirhan has been basically locked up since 1968, and Paul Schrade has gone to his parole hearing, and he can't get parole, even though he's been eligible for it since the mid to early 1980s. And he comes up every 5 years. Paul Schrade has been begging the board to free the man who shot Paul Schrade in the head, but he says he did not kill the senator. And they don't want to listen because, and by the way, just to get a little political here, one of the supposed progressive hopes for president is Kamala Harris. And the people involved in the RFK research community, many of them are very upset with her. In fact, Sirhan's attorney, Bill Pepper, who I mentioned, he said that she refused even to look at their filings when she was California Attorney General because she was so interested in just sticking with the power structure, being a tough prosecutor, that the idea that an innocent man is being held doesn't seem to make a difference to her or her staff. And the fact that the victim is one of the great progressive leaders of the last century should make a difference to voters, even if it doesn't make a difference to her.
Right. I'm not thrilled with her either. I know what you mean. Yeah, and what are the odds of these four progressive leaders all being killed off by supposedly independent lone gunmen in this, like, I don't know, what was it, like a 6 or 8 year time frame? What are the odds of that?
Well, exactly. And by the way, in three of the cases, excluding Malcolm X, there's a very clear pattern of a patsy, a fall guy, someone who was inveigled to be in the wrong spot at the wrong time. And that's when, according to many of us in the research community, the professional killers moved into action once the patsy was in the vicinity of the target. So in the instance of President Kennedy, two of the signatories of this petition were doctors at the hospital who tried to revive President Kennedy, who was dead by the time he arrived, but they still gave it a heroic shot. Now, these are doctors who saw the wounds. And to not beat around the bush, the overwhelming evidence is that the fatal shot came from the right front. And if Lee Harvey Oswald, the convicted, not convicted, but accused killer, was in the rear, how do you have a bullet from the right front?
Yeah, that's always been an interesting question. So there's so many anomalies in all of these assassinations. And I know maybe you can speak to the William Pepper, who you were just talking about, attorney William Pepper, has written a book called The Plot to Kill King, where he outlines all of his research that he's done for 30 years and also the trial that took place in 1999, I think it was, that proved that James Earl Ray didn't do it and who actually did do it. And I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
Well, I'll just add that this was at the request of the King family. So they had asked him to look into his friend's death. And Dr. Pepper was very close to Martin Luther King. In fact, they were working together on a presidential run for Dr. King in 1968 when the assassination occurred. And he, like most people, simply assumed that James Earl Ray did it. Ray started to confess, and then he backed off, but by then he had already confessed in police custody, and he spent the rest of his life dying in 1998 trying to get a new trial. But the family persisted, and they thought he was on the right track, this accused killer of their head of their family. So Bill Pepper went at great risk to his life, actually, into the Memphis area, the rural regions around it, Mississippi and Louisiana. And in talking, not just as a lawyer, but as a journalist, a very gutsy investigative journalist, which he originally was, he talked in kind of Klan, racist, mafia circles to people who might know the origin of the death plot. And he wove the story together at a trial, a civil trial in Memphis in 1999, and a jury basically found a verdict against a different person than James Earl Ray, who was dead by then. And that was a symbolic effort. The family was not looking to enrich itself, so they were not asking significant damages. I think it was just $100 damages, but they wanted to show the world what the truth was. Now, unfortunately, our media, as of which I was part, and I'm so a part, but this is a very difficult story for reporters because, okay, you've got a jury verdict, but people don't have time to read the testimony, follow it. There doesn't seem to be national media clamoring about it. And so you have, in all of these cases, breakthrough evidence that's essentially ignored, or maybe one or two little stories so that people say they've covered it, but there's no penetration to the public consciousness.
Yeah, that's very amazing to me. I always think on Martin Luther King when in January when we celebrate his birth that nobody's talking about this, and it's just mind-boggling to me. I want to scream.
I looked into that. I thought that was amazing, too. And so when I first got to know these books and evidence and so forth, I first started on the most famous of these to compile reader's guides separately of the major books, the major movies, documentaries especially, the major conferences, libraries. And I have those on the Justice Integrity Project site. If people go and look for a reader's guide, they'll find an overall compilation of the major books, whatever the theory of the case might be on these assassinations. But then I took another step, and I thought, well, there's always, you know, kind of black studies departments at universities and, you know, new generations of students and professors who study this. Let me reach out to some of them and see not only that I could promote their books on this site in whatever modest way the readership might bring, but just kind of cross-pollinate the research community and the professors and students. And here's an unfortunate, in my view, but not surprising conclusion. People need to make a living, and you're not going to get too far, despite what people might think, about focusing on who really killed Martin Luther King.
Right.
The money is in books and academic articles to talk about his legacy. The same thing with the Kennedys. Everybody wants to talk about the legacy.
Right, but Andrew, don't you think that that's controlled at some level where people who own these corporate media outlets are, you know, there's a conspiracy, I believe, going on to silence this information?
Well, yeah, but in many ways it's unthinking because I'm still a part of the media in many ways. Of some 50 years after I started at the Record Current in 1970. And for both reporters, editors, and on up, it's not necessarily that they got the memo that they have to stifle with. It just makes people uncomfortable. And just like the antelope on the African plain never read a memo to stay away from the tigers, they just know that being around the tigers is a bad idea.
So
if you're an academic trying to get tenure or get a book contract or you're a reporter trying to make your deadlines, the overwhelming sense is you just get a sense that this is not good for your future.
Right,
get
right. So there's a lot of self-censorship going on.
That's the huge part of it.
Yeah.
And if it does work it up to the higher levels, somebody will say, well, I don't think it's new. It happened a long time ago. And by the way, I was just at a gathering of minority journalists, and it was a social reception, and I raised some of this, and people would look at me like, I wasn't even born then, or that was a long time ago. And they hadn't got a memo, but they just knew that talking about who really killed Martin Luther King, as opposed to what his legacy was and, you know, how we can do stories about that, it's two different things.
And just for the listeners, probably most of them know this by now, but the assassination of Martin Luther King was actually a real conspiracy. So when people want to say, oh, you're crazy conspiracy theorists, well, that was a real conspiracy. And I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
Well, I'd love to add something to it. First of all, the term conspiracy theory was popularized by the CIA in the 1960s, and it specifically was meant to denigrate anyone who criticized the Warren Report that came out in 1964. that blamed the entire Kennedy assassination on Lee Harvey Oswald. And by the late 1960s, New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison had virtually cracked the case to find that it was a conspiracy. And he was doing a grand jury. He's the last really courageous prosecutor in American history on this. So in 1967, particularly, there was a memo in April that you can now read because it was declassified. And it was from the CIA, and it instructed its operatives to get every one of their assets in the journalism community and academia to call people who criticize the JFK assassination conspiracy theorists who are so nuts that they shouldn't have a job in journalism or universities. And that term has continued to be an insult and a smear used against people like me or other researchers without any attempt to evaluate evidence.
It's been very effective in meeting their goals of silencing people on that.
Well, and the odd thing is, I've been a lawyer now for 30 years with degrees from Yale and the University of Chicago Law School, and covering courts and just reading a newspaper, and you see that the term conspiracy is actually perhaps the most common federal charge there is. They're constantly accusing these right. defendants of conspiracy.
So they really do exist, yes.
They actually do exist. It just means two people getting together. And in the case of all four of these, it's definitely conspiracy. For one thing, it's a conspiracy to cover up the actual evidence. I mean, let me just give a quick example from the JFK case that people know a lot about. But very few people know that Oswald, the accused shooter, worked on the U-2 spy program while he was in the Marines, and that after he returned from the Soviet Union, he was clearly some kind of agent because he was working on super-sensitive classified programs like air photo interpretation during a Cuban Missile Crisis for 6 months, and he was obviously some kind of undercover government agent. That's mm-hmm. clear. And right. so that doesn't mean he did or did not fire bullets at the time. It just means that we haven't been told officially the full facts, and we need to get the government to be transparent on this as a step to be transparent on other things that are more recent.
Yeah, and your website for this petition to the Congress is called, again, it's AmericanTruthNow.org. And people can go on there and actually sign this petition demanding these reopenings of these assassination investigations. How else can they help out, Andrew?
Later there will be a donation page, but for the real activists, probably one of the main things is to be the media ourselves. That's what I encourage. And to encourage local outlets, support shows like yours, Cheryl, to cover these kinds of stories, and to ask for meetings with elected representatives to be visible. I'm a big advocate of people who have a group, getting the group to vote to take an interest in something like this, and then arranging a meeting in your district offices with the staff of your local member of Congress and just
pressure them to look into
what
this.
You, yeah. What you want, and have them bring it to the attention of the member of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
One thing is you have to have these discussions with officials be a two-way street. You can't just have your own pet issue and ignore their concerns. To have a truly effective advocacy, you've got to realize where they're coming from.
Well, Andrew, I really applaud your work, and thank you for being part of that and for being on the show today. And I want to know if you can quickly, for the JFK assassination, what's the best book someone could read to get up to speed on that?
I think a lot of people, myself included, think that the single best book is by James Douglas. It was published in 2009. It's called JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters, by James W. Douglas, who incidentally is one of the signatories on this group and is otherwise a leader. And it basically says that he was going to end the Vietnam War, and the power structure could not tolerate that.
And then for Martin Luther King?
I would say one of the Bill Pepper books, his most recent is The Plot to Kill King.
Yeah, and then for Robert F. Kennedy's assassination?
Oh, now you're going to get me in trouble because several people have just published new books on that. So I'm not going to make a total recommendation.
You can just give us a few titles then, yeah.
Okay, I got about 20 here, but I'll read two that I think are particularly good. Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy by Tim Tate and Brad Johnson. Who Killed Bobby by Shane O'Sullivan. And a new one that just came out is A Lie Too Big to Fail by Lisa Pease.
And then for Malcolm X?
I have right here in my hand The Judas Factor, The Plot to Kill Malcolm X by former Washington Post reporter Carl Evans.
Okay. Wonderful. And again, your website is
justice-integrity.org. And what a pleasure to talk with you and your audience and make me think of my happy years in Central Connecticut.
And again, you were just listening to journalist and attorney Andrew Craig. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Right, let's take all that atomic poison away. Well, we're now in the post Cold War era, an interregnum marked by major geopolitical changes, uncertainty, and an unrestrained nuclear arms race. To talk with us about an international conference to learn from a remarkable group of analysts and movement leaders from partner organizations across the U.S. and Europe and East Asia to deepen our understanding of the changing world and how we can best respond is Joseph Gerson. Joseph is the American Friends Service Committee Disarmament Coordinator. He's a director of programs in New England and is director of the Peace and Economic Security Program. He's played a leading role in building collaborations among the U.S., Asian, and European peace and nuclear weapons abolition movements. And his program work focuses on challenging and overcoming U.S. global hegemony, including its preparations for and threats to initiate nuclear war and its military domination of the Asia Pacific, and the Middle East. He's also author of the renowned, wonderful, you must read, Empire and the Bomb. And it is quite the pleasure to have you with us this morning.
Thank you, Mimi. That was quite an introduction.
Well, you're quite the person to introduce. And I want to begin by your assessment, really, at this juncture with the advent of the Trump administration and the plutocracy that occupies the seat of power now. Where do we stand with that kind of nuclear clock that was ticking closer and closer and closer to midnight? How do we define the most prominent issues and the level of threat?
Well, I think maybe the place we've got to begin is the fact that the United States is no longer considered a classical democracy. It's termed a flawed democracy, and I think that's a generous analysis. So, you know, at one level, and most basically, is the struggle here in the United States to restore some semblance of democracy, to preserve justice, and really to prevent fascism from taking over. In that context, we have the reality of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, who do their doomsday clock to serve as a warning to the world in terms of where we might stand in terms of the dangers of nuclear war. And last year, and then again this year, they set that clock at 2 minutes to midnight, midnight meaning nuclear or now environmental apocalypse. This is the closest it's been since 1953, and when it was at the same time. So the dangers are enormous. We now, spurred by the U.S. withdrawal from the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, which I know sounds pretty wonky to people, but with Trump's withdrawal from that, the commitment by the United States to spend something like $1.7 trillion for a new generation of nuclear weapons and their delivery systems, we're entering into a period of really an unrestrained nuclear arms race with Russia, to a lesser degree with China. And in addition to the possibility of some madman, we may have one in Washington, hitting the nuclear button, there's also the very real danger of nuclear weapons accidents or miscalculations during crises. So the situation is very very severe, and again complicated by the U.S. withdrawal from the INF Treaty and plans now to put medium and short range missiles into Europe, which brings us back to a situation similar to late 70s, early 80s, when the fears were so great that it sparked really a global movement.
So you really see as terribly significant the withdrawal of Trump, who was first to pull a plug on the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. And where does this fit in with the U.S. now, Russia and China, all on the brink of a dangerous and unrestrained nuclear arms race? And now give us that analysis. So the treaty was, I dare say, in your view, major significance, and as it interacts with and promotes this unrestrained war, certainly ideological war around nuclear arms with Russia and China. So is that what also pushes us even closer to that midnight hour?
Yeah. So again, just going back to a little bit of history, you had a combination of mass movements in Europe, the freeze movement here in the United States, the Common Security Commission led by Olof Palme in Sweden, and Gorbachev in the Soviet Union's understanding that he had to move to reduce spending and the danger of nuclear weapons. And all that came together ultimately in 1987 with the negotiation of the INF Treaty. We were in a situation where the U.S. was about to deploy short-range missiles that could not only hit Eastern Europe, but could basically wipe out the Soviet leadership within 8 minutes. And the negotiation of this treaty, and the Russians were also about to deploy weapons as well, The negotiation of this treaty in 1987 essentially ended the Cold War 2 years before the fall of the Berlin Wall. So this was seminal. And with Trump and Bolton removing that treaty now, it moves us back toward the confrontation with Russia. This is further complicated, and I know, most people are not paying too much attention to foreign and military policy these days, and that's understandable. But the reality is that beginning with Bill Clinton, the United States violated a fundamental agreement made with initially the Soviet Union and then obviously with Russia, that Germany could reunify on West German terms in exchange for a commitment that the United States wouldn't move NATO a centimeter closer to Moscow. And with the Clinton administration, that movement east began to the point now where you have U.S. and NATO troops all along Russia's borders. Think what the United States might think about here if there were Russian or Chinese forces in Mexico or in Canada. And, the Russians have a history, their historical memory, their frame of reference is Napoleon's disastrous invasion, World War One, and then World War Two, all invasions coming from the West. So this has really heightened the crisis, and we have very intense and provocative military exercises by both the United States and the Russians in the Baltic and the Black Sea along their borders. And the danger is that in an incident, for example, a young naval officer who, with his fingers on anti-aircraft missiles, deciding to shoot one off when a Russian plane buzzes it at 100 feet above their ship, or vice versa. So it's a situation which could spin out of control, and we have to really kind of come back from the brink. In relationship to China, and this kind of relates more to the fundamental changes in the global order, we're now in a situation where the United States has long been the dominant power and empire across the Pacific and much of Asia, and China now, more than 30 years into its reform and opening, kind of the rise of China, they're pushing back against U.S. domination. We see this militarily, we see it economically, in a whole range of areas. And so, technologically, just listen to the discussions about 5G technology. So we're in really a classical crisis of the tensions between a rising and declining power. And we need to be finding, again, a common security approach to help ensure that incidents don't lead to a disaster.
And Joseph, the major powers now, like India, and the nuclear ambitions of country like Saudi Arabia, for example, obviously pose new challenges.
This is, again, a fundamental change. Where you have, nuclear weapons technology is, 75 years old? So countries like Saudi Arabia in relationship to, in its effort to kind of remain the dominant power or a dominant power in the Middle East, is not only moving toward nuclear capacity, but really, tragically, has the support of the Trump administration in moving toward proliferation. India and Pakistan are locked in a nuclear arms race. And one of the things, we're bringing Aichin Vinayak from India, one of the co-founders of the Indian Peace and Nuclear Disarmament Movement, to our conference. I want people to understand that Physicians for Social Responsibility, leading climate scientists, did a study in which they found that even a small nuclear exchange between India and Pakistan, maybe 50 to 100 nuclear weapons. In addition to killing millions of people immediately there in South Asia, the fires would be so intense and create so much smoke that you would have what's called global cooling, resulting in famine across the northern hemisphere and killing up to 2 billion people, which is to say that the nuclear arms race in South Asia can have direct impacts on us here in the United States and across the North. So one of the goals, for me, in this conference is to kind of help build some solidarity between our movements so we can help one another moving forward.
And I also want to ask you to bring into the equation the issues of South Korea, for example. How do you look at that? And certainly, you know, the Japanese as well, to give us a kind of picture of some of the issues that will be discussed and some of the participants and some of the outreach that have been engaged in this desperate an imperative struggle to curtail and really eliminate what is now really an unrestrained nuclear arms race.
Yeah, so you know, I count myself as very lucky. We're able to bring Lee Tae-ho from Seoul. He's been the leading figure in South Korea's leading NGO, People's Solidarity for Participatory Democracy, and played a major role in the Candlelight Revolution that overthrew the last quasi-dictator. And we have not only a leader of the Japanese peace and disarmament movement, but also the Secretary General of the Organization of Atomic and Hydrogen Bomb Survivors. So we're going to be able to bring this into the room very, very well. With Korea, you know, we have the situation in which Trump, as he often does, so totally overreacts and attempted to bully everybody with his fire and fury rhetoric and military preparations. And as we all know, this brought us to the brink of what would have been a catastrophic war. We're able to pull back from the brink, not because of Trump's genius or lack thereof, but because of the brilliant diplomacy of South Korea's President Moon. So now, you know, as we know from the failure of the U.S. North Korean summit in Hanoi, which the United States again overstepped, and with Bolton and Pompeo just made demands that could not be met. What we're going to hear, I expect, from Lee Tae-ho is going to be, look, we need to keep this diplomacy going. The United States, we need support from popular movements in the United States to press U.S. policy to be seeking incremental changes that can move toward trust building between the United States and North Korea so you can move toward more fundamental agreements. I mean, the United States destroyed in the Korean War about 90% of everything that stood in North Korea. We've prepared and threatened to initiate nuclear attack against them at least 9 times. So, you know, they have reason to be scared, which is not to say they're a particularly good government. So I think what we'll be hearing there is calling for the United States to say that the Korean War is finally over, to begin negotiations to replace the armistice agreement with a peace system, as they call it, and also to at least remove some of the sanctions so that you can have deepened South Korean, North Korean economic cultural collaboration to kind of move toward a more peaceful system. The danger, of course, here is that with the collapse of the diplomacy and with an election coming, we could be moving back to the brink, and we need to prevent that. With our Japanese partners, Japan and Britain are the two countries where nuclear disarmament movement is very much a social movement. I mean, they have on the anniversaries of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there are world conferences against ANH bombs that bring together more than 20,000 people, and you know the annual official ceremonies bring together probably about 50,000 people, maybe even with about 70,000 people. So it's very deep in the culture, they'll be coming with concerns about the accelerated nuclear arms race. I think they'll be urging us to remember that next year, 2020, marks the 75th anniversary of the atomic bombings, and urging us to kind of move to raise this in our understanding and in our organizing.
Since you mentioned that the 75th anniversary of Hiroshima and Nagasaki A bombings will occur in 2020, talk a bit about, I know you're really at the conference is being held at the midway point of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty PREPCOM at the United Nations. Talk about that and some of the strategies that are developing to influence the outcome of the PREPCOM that is going to be held at the United Nations.
Sure. So, I mean, first of all, people need to understand what the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty is. It was maybe one of the three most important treaties of the 20th century, a fundamental deal in which the non-nuclear weapon states committed to remain non-nuclear, not to have nuclear weapons, and in exchange, the nuclear weapon states, on the one hand, made the mistake of saying that the other countries had the right to generate nuclear power for peaceful purposes, but also they committed in Article 6 to engage in good faith negotiations for the complete elimination of their nuclear arsenals. And frankly, the rest of the world is at the way that the United States and the other nuclear powers have resisted implementing this commitment, which is now more than a 40-year-old commitment. With the review conferences, and there'll be a review conference in 2020, this is a chance for the governments of the world to try to hold one another accountable, including in reference to Article 6. The PREPCOM is sort of a preparation for that. And you know, in the middle now of a accelerated nuclear arms race and increased dangers, the expectations for the outcomes of those, you know, the PREPCOM and the review conferences are not high. But we need to understand that the rest of the world is not only angry, they've been doing something about it. And so, 2 years ago, at the UN, 122 countries promulgated a treaty called the Nuclear Prohibition Treaty, Nuclear Weapons Prohibition Treaty, which reaffirms, you know, their commitments to the NPT, and is designed to put more pressure on the nuclear weapons states. So I think what we'll see at the PREPCOM, and certainly in 2020, certainly the Japanese will be pushing it, many of the Europeans, that we need to move toward full implementation, full, you know, more universal signing and ratification of the treaty. It goes into effect when 50 countries have signed it, and pressure for the United States and other nuclear powers to begin moving towards serious consideration and maybe signing the treaty. We look, I mean, one of the things that we look at in terms of how things work politically, in Britain, you know, with their struggle over Brexit, there's a chance that Jeremy Corbyn of the Labour Party will come to power in a coming election. If so, he's pledged to sign the ban treaty. That's to say, a nuclear weapons state would sign the treaty. It would be a major, major change. Similarly, in Australia, I mean, where I say that a lot of the rubber hits the road is in the so-called umbrella states, the countries that are in some ways, their military policy is dependent on U.S. Nuclear weapons threats. And again, there, the Labour Party is on the verge of taking power. If it does, a majority of their members of parliament have said they'll back the ban. So you do have some openings and some cracks in the system that could help us to build back.
And lastly, one of the things that we've really got to talk about is that at this nuclear disarmament conference, you've specifically invited speakers from the Movement for Black Lives Matters and U.S. Labor Against the War. The synthesis that is in imperative to break through our kind of being siloed, or the bifurcation between anti-war movements and anti-nuclear proliferation movements and so on, the imperative for these movements to come together, and the understanding that this is a working session conference to really progress in a more holistic and comprehensive way to surge ahead to stop the proliferation of the nuclear arms race.
Yeah, I mean, we have an understanding that the issues are connected. They don't exist separate from one another. Among other things, if you're going to spend $1.7 trillion for nuclear weapons, What does that mean in terms of funding for housing? What does that mean in terms of the cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency? What does that mean in terms of you know, kind of reinforcing the structures of racism that we have? The causes are connected, and you know, siloed movements rarely prevail. It's certainly the case for peace and nuclear disarmament movements. So we understand not only do we want to bring the struggles for justice into our movement, we want peace activists to understand that they need to be part of the struggles against racism for economic and social justice and for the environment here in the United States. So we're hoping that with Reverend Griffith Sekou and with Reese Chenault, that they'll move people and I think others, you know, some number of the white speakers as well. We'll be talking about how essential it is that we move toward more integrated organizing.
And I should say that some of the sessions that you will be able to hear, and there'll be a keynote by the wonders of the virtual airwaves, the video by the magnificent, the most important whistleblower of the last century, who continues to be active every step of the way, Daniel Ellsberg, on the urgency of the moment and possible actions. You'll be able to understand more comprehensively the new geopolitical and military disorders, their nuclear dimensions, and the forces that are driving them, and the new geopolitical and military disorders. And aside from that, you can help do what is imperative to stop the hands of that clock pushing ever closer to midnight. And just lastly, Joseph Gerson.
The one thing we didn't touch on as we close here, just to say, is one of the unique.
And we have about 30 seconds.
One of the unique aspects is we have two democracy, disarmament, and environmental leaders coming from Russia. There's quite a struggle to get their visas. And given the nature of U.S.-Russian relations, this is really a rare opportunity for people to hear what progressives in Russia are thinking about.
And the overall theme really is the urgency of the moment and possible actions. It's an exciting, comprehensive, imperative form. And you'll hear people like Joseph Gerson, who's worked so hard to put this together. And it's been our pleasure to speak with Joseph Gerson, American Friends Service Committee's disarmament coordinator. And I do, again, encourage you to get the book, the renowned book, Empire and the Bomb. We've got a lot of work to do. Joseph, thank you for being our guest.
Mimi, thank you very much for this opportunity. It's always great to talk to you.
I'm Mimi Rosenberg. Thank you so much for listening. Stop nuclear proliferation. It is our lives.
Just give me the
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
My name is Pete Buttigieg. I am a proud son of South Bend, Indiana, and I am running for president of the United States. The horror show in Washington is mesmerizing. It's all-consuming. But starting today, we're going to change the channel.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Marriage equality debuts in Japan's court system, European Lesbian Conference overcomes tear gas-toting protesters, and Buttigieg's presidential bid breaks into the big time. Those stories and more this week, now that you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Michael Lebeau.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending April 20th, 2019. A court in Japan began hearing the country's first lawsuit challenging the definition of civil marriage as exclusively heterosexual. Article 24 of the nation's constitution says that marriage shall be based only on the mutual consent of both sexes. 13 couples filed the lawsuit on Valentine's Day. They range in age from their 20s to 60s. In addition to ending Japan's marriage inequality, they're demanding financial compensation of 1 million yen and all trial costs. On the first day of the trial, two of the plaintiffs described the challenges they face every day, including social stigma in the conservative country. 40-year-old breast cancer survivor Haru Ono has been with her partner for 14 years. She discussed the difficulties the couple faced during her treatment when the hospital denied her partner the right to participate in medical decision-making. She said that in addition to facing life-threatening illness, she had to worry about parental custody and inheritance issues involving the three children from previous heterosexual marriages that the couple has been raising. Gay plaintiff Aikuo Sato is HIV positive and also worried about medical treatment and inheritance issues. As if to demonstrate Japan's continuing social stigma, his deeply closeted partner is not a part of the lawsuit and has not been in the courtroom. The first day of the trial was a genuine baby step. One of the lawyers for the couples, Shigenori Nakagawa, said that it could be up to 5 years before any ruling is announced.
Meanwhile, 157 same-gender couples are planning to apply for marriage licenses in Taiwan on May 24th. That's the deadline set by the Constitutional Court 2 years ago when it ordered that civil marriage be opened to lesbian and gay couples. The legislative yuan has been unable to pass the necessary legislation thus far, and the court said that marriage equality would automatically come into force on May 24, 2019, if lawmakers fail to act by then. The Coalition for the Happiness of Our Next Generation, the conservative Christian group that sponsored referenda on the November ballot, is calling on legislators to adhere to the results. Voters rejected marriage equality while supporting less-than-marriage civil unions. No one can predict what will happen between now and May 24th.
About 35 far-right religious zealots protested the start on April 11th in the Ukrainian capital of Kiev of the European Lesbian Conference. They blocked the entrance to the hotel and held signs saying, "Homosexuality is a disease," and "Go back to hell, sodomites." Some of the protesters tried to break into the hotel carrying tear gas canisters, but police were able to hold them off. They still broke windows and scrawled homophobic slogans on the walls outside. The ultimately successful conference went on with heightened security. Organizers said about 350 people from 40 countries attended the three-day event. "Are you scared?" one of the first speakers asked the crowd, which drew a loud chorus of "No." Another speaker said that the protesters only represented a small minority of people in Ukraine. "The majority are too busy trying to make ends meet to care about us lesbians," she said. "It's our goal to make sure they don't end up joining those protesters."
At least 11 people with red tape across their mouths were arrested in the Russian city of St. Petersburg on April 17th during an annual Day of Silence for Sexual and Gender Equality. According to organizers, about 45 people participated. The event is a student-led action to highlight the silencing and erasure of LGBTQ communities across Russia. The detainees, other than having red tape over their mouths, were walking peacefully toward the Church of the Savior when police took each of them into custody. They carried no placards nor other LGBTQ identifying symbols. The police claimed that the arrests were for violating administrative code regulations governing rallies, but activists say that individuals don't need government permission to walk down the street and that the arrests were illegal. One of them blamed right-wing homophobes for calling the police.
Police in oppressively anti-queer Malaysia have been questioning activist Numan Afifi about a speech he gave at a United Nations conference in Geneva last month, highlighting discrimination against the LGBTQ community. It came during the UN Human Rights Commission's Universal Periodic Review of the Southeast Asian nation. "The statement I read," he told the Star News outlet, "was made on behalf of a coalition of 12 Malaysian organizations that work on gender identity and sexual orientation. We commended the government for its anti-bullying campaign in schools," he said, "but raised concerns that Malaysia has rejected many other recommendations to improve its treatment of LGBTQ people." He added that, "I will not bow down to these acts to harass or intimidate me as a human rights defender in Malaysia." He said he's yet to hear from police officials about any resolution of their so-called investigation.
Among the latest actions against Brunei and its ruling sultan over new laws punishing gay sex with death by stoning, the European Parliament adopted a resolution this week calling on the tiny Southeast Asian nation and its ruler to repeal them. The final stages in Brunei's complete conversion to Islamic law, or Sharia, became effective on April 3rd. The new Sharia-based penal code also punishes some other offenses with amputation. The Europarlament's Vice President Federica Mogherini said that no crime justifies an amputation or torture, and no person should be punished for loving someone. That can never be interpreted as a crime. But European lawmakers stopped short of punitive measures. Some had called for the freezing of assets of the Sultan and his family, visa bans, and the blacklisting of 9 luxury hotels that the royals own. Brunei officials continue to defend the harsh new laws. Government statements claim that such severe enforcement will be rare and that whippings will be conducted only with moderate force. You can find a list of those 9 luxury hotels and more about the ongoing boycott of all things Brunei at thiswayout.org.
The fallout continues from Donald Trump's ban on qualified transgender enlistees in the U.S. Armed Forces. The nation's military academies will not be admitting new transgender students under the new Pentagon policy that took effect on April 12th. The Naval Academy has announced that it will reject transgender applicants starting with the 2020 school year. A spokesman said the Air Force Academy would conform to Defense Department policy when admitting future cadets. The Coast Guard Academy in New London, Connecticut, confirmed that it would also stop admitting trans candidates. The U.S. Military Academy and the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy are expected to fall in line in short order.
Meanwhile, at the University of Texas at Austin, a second-year scholarship cadet in ROTC, the Reserve Officers Training Corps, has now lost his scholarship. 19-year-old trans man Map Pesqueira has had top surgery and takes hormones to support his transition. He's been studying to be a filmmaker and was looking forward to serving in the Army. He told reporters that the ROTC Army Department chair at the University of Texas asked the Defense Department for a grandfather exemption to let Pesqueira continue in the program and keep his scholarship. Those exemptions have been given to some active duty trans troops who've already transitioned or are in the process, but the request was denied. Since his story broke in the Texan Daily newspaper, a GoFundMe page has been helping Pesqueira cover the costs of his continued education. He reportedly raised more than $6,500 in the first 5 days. His goal is $20,000. In an email message to Gay Star News, Pesqueira said that he is extremely grateful to be supported by so many people who are rooting for me.
And finally, more than 5,000 people have signed an online petition urging administrators of Taylor University, an evangelical Christian college in Mike Pence's home state of Indiana, to dump the vice president as commencement speaker because his professed religious beliefs are not consistent with the Christian ethic of love we hold dear. Honoring Pence and giving him a coveted platform for his political views, the Change.org petition says, makes our alumni, faculty, staff, and current students complicit in the Trump-Pence administration's policies. out 2007 Taylor University alumnus Alex Hoekstra, started the petition. He told NBC News that the Trump-Pence administration's policies don't represent Christianity, Jesus, or the Bible. The school's student newspaper, The Echo, reported that 61 of the university's 113 faculty members supported a motion of dissent when Pence's selection as graduation speaker was announced, but university administrators are sticking by Pence. One of the more ridiculous reactions to the petition from the far right came from televangelist Franklin Graham. Apparently not wanting to cloud the issue with facts, he asked instead on his Facebook page, "What are these people smoking?"
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending April 20th, 2019. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast.
And now you can be the first on your block to hear News Wrap each week by subscribing to our This Way Out Radio YouTube channel. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm John Dyer V.
Back home again in Indiana, and it seems that I can see.
The only thing growing faster than South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg's popularity among Democratic hopefuls for the U.S. presidency is the number of Democrats who have also thrown their hats into the ring. 19 so far. In an April 18th poll by the mid-level ranked group Change Research, Buttigieg placed third below former Vice President Joe Biden and 2016 Democratic runner-up Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. The as-yet-undeclared Biden has dropped 15% since the last Change Research poll in March, while Buttigieg has seen a 15% rise. Mayor Pete officially announced his candidacy to become the first openly gay U.S. president at an April 14th rally in his hometown.
I'm here to join you to make a little news. My name is Pete Buttigieg. They call me Mayor Pete. I'm a proud son of South Bend, Indiana, and I am running for president of the United States. The principles that will guide my campaign for president are simple enough to fit on a bumper sticker: freedom, security, and democracy. First comes freedom, something our conservative friends have come to think of as their own. But let me tell you, freedom does not belong to just one political party. Freedom has been Democratic bedrock ever since the New Deal. Freedom from want, freedom from fear. Our conservative friends care about freedom, but they only make it part of the way. They only see freedom from taxes, freedom from regulation, as though government were the only thing that can make somebody unfree. But it's not true. Your neighbor can make you unfree. Your cable company can make you unfree. Your freedom depends on a lot more than just the size of your government. Healthcare is freedom, because you're not free if you can't start a small business when leaving your job means losing your healthcare. Consumer protection is freedom, because you're not free if you can't sue your credit card company even after they get caught ripping you off. Racial justice is freedom, because you're not free if there's a veil of mistrust between people of color and the officers sworn to keep us safe. Women's equality is freedom. Because you're not free if your reproductive health choices are dictated by male politicians or bosses. Organized labor sows freedom, because you're not free if you can't organize for a fair day's pay for a good day's work. And take it from Chasten and me, you're not free if a county clerk gets to tell you who you ought to marry because of their idea of their political beliefs. The chance to live a life of your choosing, in keeping with your values, that is freedom in its richest sense. And we know that good government secures freedom just as much as bad government denies it. Now let's talk about security. There is a lot more to safety and security than putting up a wall from sea to shining sea. To those in charge of our border policy, I want to make this clear. The greatest nation in the world should have nothing to fear from children fleeing violence. And even more importantly, children fleeing violence ought to have nothing to fear from the greatest country in the world. Security means keeping us safe in the face of violent white nationalism rearing its ugly head around the country. And let's pick our heads up to face what might be the greatest security issue of our time, climate change and climate disruption. No region of our country is immune to that threat. We've seen it in the floods in Nebraska, the tornadoes in Alabama, the hurricane in Puerto Rico, and the fires in California. And we're not even having a contest over whose climate plan is better, because only one side brought forth any plans at all. Our economy is on the line, our future is on the line, lives are on the line. So let's call this what it is: climate security, a life and death issue for our generation. And now let's talk about democracy. Our democratic republic is an elegant system, but lately it hasn't been quite democratic enough. It's not democratic enough if legitimate voters are denied the ability to exercise their rights because one side thinks as a matter of political strategy that they're better off if fewer citizens are able to vote. It is hardly democracy if Citizens United means that dollars can drown out the will of the people. It's not much of a republic if our districts are drawn so that politicians get to choose their voters instead of the other way around. It's nowhere near the democracy that I swore to protect with my life when U.S. citizens from Washington, D.C. to Puerto Rico don't even have the same political representation as the rest of us. And we can't say it's much of a democracy when twice in my lifetime the Electoral College has overruled the American people. So let's make it easier to register and to vote. Let's make our districts fairer. Let's make our courts less political, our structures more inclusive. And yes, let's pick our president by counting up all the ballots and giving it to the woman or man who got the most votes. The horror show in Washington is mesmerizing. It's all-consuming. But starting today, we're going to change the channel.
After outlining his policy agenda, Buttigieg changed the channel to talk about how his personal journey led to his decision to run for president.
We stand on the shoulders of optimistic women and men. Women and men who knew that optimism is not a lack of knowledge, it is a source of courage. And it will take courage to move on from our past. We're not going back. You know, if I did get a chance to go back, it wouldn't be out of a desire to live in that past. If I went into the past, I'd go just 20 years back. So I could find a teenage boy in the basement of his parents' brick house, thinking long thoughts as he played the same guitar lick over and over again on his little Stratocaster, wondering how he could belong in this world. Wondering if his intellectual curiosity means he'll never fit in. Wondering if his last name will be a stumbling block for the rest of his life. Wondering what it means when he sometimes feels a certain way about young men he sees in the hall at school. That means he'll never wear the uniform, never be accepted, never know love. If I found him and told him what was ahead, would he believe me? I can picture it if I could put my arm around him and tell him that he was going to see the world and serve his country, that he would not only find belonging in his hometown, but be entrusted by its citizens with the duty of leading it and shaping it. That he would have a hand in transforming the neighborhoods he knew as a boy, and that he would help the lights come back on in that giant factory whose broken windows loomed like the faces of a ghost over the ballpark where his dad used to take him to games, where he wondered if this city was his own. To tell him that he'll be all right. More than all right. To tell him that one rainy April day, before he even turns 40, he'll wake up to headlines about whether he's rising too quickly into becoming a top-tier contender for the American presidency. And to tell him that on that day when he announces his campaign for president, he'll do it with his husband looking on. How can you live that story and not believe that America deserves our optimism, deserves our courage, and deserves our hope? Yes, running for office is an act of hope. So is supporting someone running for office. So this afternoon, are you not hopeful? Do we not live in a country that can overcome the bleakness of a challenging and divided moment? Are you ready to turn the page and start a new chapter in the American story? If you join me, if you and I rise together to meet this moment, one day they will write histories, not just about one campaign or one presidency, but about the era that began here today in this building where past, present, and future meet, right here this chilly day in South Bend. So with hope in our hearts and with fire in our bellies, let's get to work and let's make history.
You can bet that Mayor Pete Buttigieg's campaign trail will be lined with notable firsts, like his heart-to-heart lesbian journalist-to-gay candidate chat with MSNBC's Rachel Maddow about coming out. Maybe not so groundbreaking to anyone who's been around queer activism for a long time, but ask yourself how many heterosexual voters ever get to hear about the LGBTQ experience from the inside in. This interview perfectly demonstrates the importance of newsroom diversity.
I was the first openly gay American Rhodes Scholar, and I got there, and I had come out in college, so I applied for the Rhodes Scholarship as an openly gay person. It definitely came up in the selection process, and then I got there, and I learned that I was the first American who'd ever been out.
Wow.
But that was a decade before you. And you went through college, and then the Rhodes Scholarship process, and the getting the Rhodes Scholarship, and going to work for McKinsey, and joining the Navy, and deploying to Afghanistan, and coming home, and running for mayor in your hometown, and getting elected before you came out at the age of 33.
Yeah.
And I bring this up and I acknowledge it's a difficult question, not because it's bad that you didn't come out to your 33, but I think it would have killed me to be closeted for that long. I just think about what it takes as a human being to know something and to have to bifurcate your public life. And for you to have had all of those difficult transitions and experiences and to be aiming as high as you were all of that time and not coming out until your early 30s, I just wonder if that was hurtful to you, if it hurt you to do it.
It was hard. It was really hard.
Coming out is hard, but being in the closet is harder.
Yeah, no, that's what I mean. I mean, it was and it wasn't. First of all, it took me plenty of time to come out to myself. So I did not, the way you did or the way my husband did, figure out at such an early age that I probably should have. I mean, there's certain plenty of indications by the time I was 15 or so that I could point back and be like, this kid's gay. I guess I just really needed to not be. And, you know, there's this war that breaks out, I think, inside a lot of people when they realize that they might be something they're afraid of. Mm-hmm. And it took me a very long time to resolve that. I did make sure, as a kind of final way of coming out to myself, to come out to at least a couple of people in my life before I took office, because I knew that I didn't want to have that kind of psychological pressure, or at least not being out to somebody. It was really the deployment that put me over the top. I realized that you only get to be one person. You don't know how long you have on this earth. And by the time I came back, I realized, like, I got to do something.
Were you sure at the time when you came out that it would cost you re-election?
I was pretty sure it was going to be a big complication, but I had no idea. I mean, I felt like things were going well in the city. I felt like I'd done a good job by the people of South Bend, and I had some level of trust that I would be rewarded for that with a re-election. But there's no way to really know. There was no playbook. I mean, no executive in Indiana had ever been out.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was kind of a leap of faith. And I just, you know, I wrote it all down, put it in an op-ed,
dropped it in the South Bend Tribune and woke up that day and saw what would happen.
And then got reelected with 80% of the vote.
And then there you go. Yeah. So you treat people, you trust people, and at least in this case, they reciprocated that trust. And, you know, that was more than I got elected in the first place. I guess it's one thing that gives me a lot of encouragement. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's plenty of ugliness that comes in from all over the place. But most people, I think, are either supportive or even enthusiastic about the idea of the first out person going this far. Or they find a way to let me know they don't care. Mm-hmm. And that's historic, too. One of the things that I think I can do before the first vote is cast is maybe make it a little easier just by being here for the next person who comes along.
I've had a number of conversations with people since the Rachel Maddow interview.
Me too.
Some are furious that she asked the question at all. Lesbians.
Ann Northrup and Andy Hulme of Gay USA discussed reactions to Maddow's interview with Buttigieg and how focus on that media moment might serve to mask some more dubious aspects of Mayor Pete's record.
I think there is certainly something to be discussed in terms of his process, and we don't agree on all of this, but to me it portrays quite vividly for the American people, because he talks about his fear and not wanting to be this. And I think that just echoes what I have observed over the years, which is those with the most privilege, those with the most ambition, those most invested in the status quo are the most fearful. It also distracts us from a lot of Pete's actual political history and opinions about issues. And there are those who are paying attention and saying, you know, he did some South Bend redevelopment that really threw a lot of people of color out of their houses and was too fast. And even Pete has said, well, maybe we didn't do that the right way. And he fired a black police chief, and people have gotten on him about that. And he said, I regret that.
Stephen Thrasher, an African-American gay journalist, wrote, this candidacy is going to expose fault lines between the white gay men and the rest of the LGBT community. And he says, queer America is a lot to the left of the white, married, gay, God-fearing centrist. And Sarah Schulman, who's more radical, also made similar comments. She says, I'm not criticizing this individual who has become himself, but I am disappointed that militarism, God, and marriage is what we have to do to be taken seriously.
I do think it's an evolution in people's thinking and understanding, and I think it is unimaginable that he, as an out gay man, could have run until about now.
That was Ann Northrup and Andy Hulme of Gay USA. Whether or not the social and economic fault lines in the LGBT community will prove to be as deep and destructive as those in the larger U.S. society, and the impact that could have on presidential politics, remains to be seen. It's worth noting that the current top trio in the Democratic presidential primary campaign is the all-white boy band of Biden, Bernie, and Buttigieg. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Michael LeBeau and John Dyer V, produced with Brian DeShazer. Jim Nabors and ANAF performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, Paul Bannon, Richard Merck, and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all of the listener donors who make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email TWORadio on AOL.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KXSU Seattle, Washington, to MTM Coonamble, New South Wales, WDIY Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and some 200 stations and other outlets around the world, including this one. Now y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Arguably, some of the central issues of our time involve authoritarianism versus liberation, especially with the rise of the populist right around the world. These were themes that animated the life of philosopher Herbert Marcuse. Born in Germany in 1898, he participated in the failed revolution that followed World War I, and then observed the rise of the Nazis in the 1920s and 30s as a member of the influential Institute for Social Research, otherwise known as the Frankfurt School. When the Nazi threat led to the relocation en masse of the Frankfurt School to the United States, Marcuse examined not only the forces of repression, but the liberatory impulses in society toward utopian change. Reviled by the likes of then-California Governor Ronald Reagan and John Wayne, he found himself threatened and out of a job on more than one occasion. But he also found a mass audience in second-wave feminism and the New Left. Author and illustrator Nick Torkelson has written a graphic biography of Marcuse, in effect a comic book of weighty ideas, called Herbert Marcuse, Philosopher of Utopia. It's published by City Lights Books. Nick, what were Marcuse's origins, and into what world was he born?
He was born into the assimilated German-Jewish bourgeoisie. His father owned a factory at the time he was born, and so did his grandfather, his mother's father. And the story that is always told, which I use in the book to express what that culture was like, is that Marcuse used to say that in his neighborhood as a child, you would hear somebody leaning out the window and saying, "Siegfried, Brunhilde, it's time for Shabbos." So this was that, and like a lot of his colleagues later in the Frankfurt School, he was encouraged to be to have the kind of culture that would signify the arrival of into the comfortable classes, and that was part of the impetus. And there's no saying what else went into his tremendous intellectual curiosity, except that then he was a soldier and had the experiences that set the course for him.
World War One was a horrible slaughter, and Germany was, of course, one of the losing powers. What were the circumstances of that moment in Marcuse's young adulthood and his participation in the revolutionary politics in Germany at the time?
Yes, he became interested in socialism as a soldier. He had poor eyesight, so he didn't see any action. He was in the rear echelon taking care of the horses. And he was appalled by the corruption of the war and the slaughter and the arrogance of the officer classes, which was extreme and probably much in a very different and very vexing way in the rear echelon compared to where the fighting was going on. And in the comic, this is, you know, a lot of, in a graphic biography, you have to make some stuff up because you're not there, so you supply some words for the people. And for me, I imagined, without knowing that this ever happened, that he overheard two plutocrats at their private club saying, "Isn't this war wonderful? This is how the money rolls in." We know that from his recollections that profiteering and the great fortunes that were created by the war for certain people was part of what made him want to look for a different way. And so he was recruited into the Social Democratic Party, and he came out of and at the end of the war, after the Social Democratic Party had the advantage of an uprising to replace the monarchy with the republic, and then turned against the working class people who were their base, he joined the rebellion against the Social Democratic Party, which he had belonged to, and he joined. He was a soldier's delegate, and he took up arms against the regime. That was the Spartacist uprising that led to the martyrdom of Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht and others, and it was the first of a number of traumas that informed his thinking and made him a revolutionary and made him, and unlike many people in the Spartacist rebellion who then went on to form the German branch of the communist movement, he did not go for that. He thought that they were too attached to the Soviet Union as opposed to the socialist cause, and so he kept himself independent, but he was very much of the left, and while not an active revolutionary distributing rifles to anybody, he was looking in his intellectual work for ways of thinking about radical change and revolutionary change.
So you were just describing how the 1919 uprising gave Marcuse a taste of revolution, and that was to become an abiding theme throughout his life, revolution, the possibility of utopian transformation of society. And yet, of course, the period that followed that, the Weimar years, were times of enormous tumult, certainly of militancy on the far left, but also the far right. Tell us about that period, what was going on in terms of the world of ideas and culture, and then also on the street.
Well, in my book, there are a couple of pages or so devoted to the culture of that time, and it allowed me to talk about some of the stuff that has interested me for a long time, the theater of Brecht and Weill and Eisner and that bohemian segueing into left-wing culture that we associate with Weimar, and also the New Objectivity movement, which produced George Grosz's extremely powerful and upsetting images of what he saw around him, of the corruption and the brutality of that society. And politically, it was a time that reminds me of the aftermath of the Vietnam War, where you had in this country, you had Vietnam veterans against the war who were extreme rebels. I don't like that word extreme for them. I thought they were reasonable rebels who learned on account of their experiences in the war what a corrupt system had created that war and made people want to think about ways of struggling against that. And at the same time, it created the backlash, super patriotic POW MIA kind of veteran consciousness that was pushing in the opposite direction. So in Germany, chiefly with the communists on one side and the Nazis on the other, you had tremendous participation by war veterans, and some of them looked at the war. They were both talking about war as trauma, but for one group, the trauma was that capitalism had created an impossible situation and a lethal situation, and for the other group, the trauma of war signified that they had been betrayed and that they did not get the glory that they deserved because they were stabbed in the back by the civilian and Jewish traitors back at home. So that is something that I think carries through both of Marcuse's important periods, the times that formed him and the times when he was famous and had a great influence.
Marcuse became interested in the philosophy of Martin Heidegger, who attracted a following in these years and had a very complicated political future. But at that moment, people like Hannah Arendt and others flocked to his lectures. Now, Marcuse is someone coming out of the left, out of a left-wing political world. What attracts him about Heidegger, and what did Heidegger offer that was not offered by the reigning ideas of the time, including Orthodox Marxism?
Well, the way I look at it, and these are very dense and difficult ideas, and I did my best. I have no philosophical training, so I was very helpful to read the writings of Andy Feinberg, who was a graduate student of Marcuse's and wrote a lot about the Heidegger-Marcuse relationship. The way I understand it is that having decided to go into academia because he did not see any place for him in the politics of that time, he started to study philosophy, and the reigning orthodoxy of the time was the neo-positivists of the so-called Vienna School, who, to his mind, in their sense of how do we know, how do we perceive, and all these philosophical questions, were basically leaving you with the impression that reality is immutable, and what you see is what you get, and don't make waves because that's out there and that's real, and your subjectivity is merely subjectivity. So what I think happened when he read Being and Time, the magnum opus of Martin Heidegger, was that he was thrilled by Heidegger's idea that you know something by doing it, you know something by acting upon it, and that this heroizing and philosophizing of action and taking responsibility for the world and not assuming that it is immutable and that it's going to control you was how his philosophical pursuits meshed with his political history at that point. And so he speaks of having a friend and reading Being in Time word for word for days on end, and then spending hours talking about it. And there was nothing he could do besides go to Freiburg, where Heidegger was teaching by then, and be his graduate student and his assistant. And he also worked with Heidegger's mentor, Edmund Husserl, who was at Freiburg also. So that was the connection as I make it out. And as the book lays out, he began to try and write about his thoughts in connection to phenomenology and Heidegger, he began to see that there was not that the content of the action of the taking responsibility that Heidegger was talking about was not necessarily part of the philosophy, and that was something that was lacking. That the world that you're trying to create has a shape and a form and certain qualities, and that was missing. That was the beginning of his differentiating himself from Heidegger.
What ideas was he grappling with at that time? You know, much philosophy was focusing on the role of the artist. How did he see the role of the artist and the relevance of that to the larger society?
Marcuse had written, I think in the German system, I'm not sure if this is still true, but you did two dissertations, one to get the degree and one to get a job. So he had done his first dissertation on the subject of the artist novel. This is before he had his Saul of Tarsus moment and decided to work with Heidegger. He was, I'm not even certain that he had a strict philosophy discipline. I think he wanted to combine cultural studies with philosophy, and he was interested in his mentor at that point was not, I think maybe just a little older than him, George Lukács, who had written some really interesting stuff about how the artist and bourgeois society proceeds from a place of alienation, and that this was not always true and it need not be true. And so Marcuse wrote this very interesting dissertation called the German Artist Novel, tracing from medieval times from the Icelandic epics up through 20th century literature, and one of his favorite authors, Thomas Mann, with a special emphasis on Goethe in between, about how the artist came to this, how the artist came to seeing the world as something separate from their subjectivity. And so you can see how this meshes with the idea of the subjective soul and society, and the longing to break down that separateness between the lonely philosopher, the lonely artist, and the society outside, and reunite what had been an organic whole.
Nick Torkelson is my guest. We're talking about his graphic biography, which he's the author and illustrator of, Herbert Marcuse, Philosopher of Utopia, and that's published by City Lights Books. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So tell us about the formation of the Institute for Social Research, which usually is referred to as the Frankfurt School, the grouping of thinkers around that, and how Marcuse ended up being involved in it.
Yes, the Institute for Social Research was founded by Felix Weil. He was, like Marcuse, a veteran who had come to some revolutionary and some Marxist ideas as a result of the bitterness of his experience in the war and in the struggles afterwards. And it was an attempt to bring some people together to think about social change and in relation to culture, in relation to politics. And it was, the original director was not Felix Weil, it was Carl Grunberg, who was probably very attached to the Soviet experiment and had set up a formal relationship between the Institute and the Marx-Lenin Institute in Moscow, and was also, according to some of the students at the Institute, a somewhat naive optimist who saw history marching inexorably towards a socialist and cooperative future, and spoke of and was very interested in doing empirical research. When he became too ill to lead it, then Max Horkheimer took over, and he is remembered as the leader of the Frankfurt School in its glory days. And Theodor Adorno came in, Leo Löwenthal, and later on Eric Fromm, and around that same time Marcuse, who joined at the beginning of the 30s when it was clear that that the Nazis were on the march and that he was not going to have an academic career in Germany. So That's the origin story, and it's worth mentioning that the Felix Weil, like Herbert Marcuse, came from a very comfortable background. His father was a grain merchant who lived a large part of his career and did his business in South America. So the resources that supported the research of the institute came from the third world, I think you could say.
What were the Frankfurt School's preoccupations? Obviously, different thinkers, but what were the main preoccupations in terms of the ideas they were wrestling? And what was the relationship of the Frankfurt School with Marxism broadly conceived?
The Frankfurt School, I would say, is remembered for its critique of consumerism and false consciousness. They began by wanting to know why the revolution of 1919 failed. I think that was probably a major preoccupation in the 20s. And they then wrote a lot about authoritarianism as they saw the collapse of the left in Germany as the Nazis came to power, and in their years of exile during the war. And the Dialectic of Enlightenment, the major work of Adorno and Horkheimer, is about how the ideas of that we associate with republicanism and small R republicanism and the French Revolution and classic liberalism and the late Renaissance that led to modernity, that the seeds of authoritarianism and the seeds of a thoroughly administered society, as Adorno called it, were planted by these ideas that seem so progressive and that we think of as so progressive. And so the preoccupation of the Frankfurt School was authoritarianism and submission to authoritarianism, and as ballast against the rebellions and the transformations that Marxism predicted and hoped for. And I should say that as the Frankfurt School was suppressed by the Nazis and they had to flee, they were in the midst of what was going to be a gigantic empirical study of workers' attitudes, and this was at the time of tremendous mass socialist parties in Germany and throughout Central Europe, and even before their defeat, Erich Fromm and Paul Lazarsfeld were managed the study of workers' attitudes, and they came to the conclusion after getting a lot of questionnaires back that many workers who identified with the left were nevertheless longing for leadership and were not being guided in their politics towards autonomy and towards liberation, what we would think of as liberation. And so a certain kind of radical pessimism was kind of built into their politics from the start.
So how did then the rise of Nazism end up affecting Marcuse and the Frankfurt School?
Very differently, I would say. The Frankfurt School went from Frankfurt to Geneva as it was becoming after Hitler was announced appointed chancellor. And they didn't find Switzerland particularly welcoming. This was a surprise to me when I was doing the research that there was a lot of fascist feeling in Switzerland, and there was a lot of fascist feeling in the U.S. It had not done the worst of the damage it was going to do, and a lot of people were very, very charmed or excited by that Heideggerian thing, the heroism against what is. That was the appeal of fascism for a lot of people, and the militarism of it was went with that. So Marcuse and a lot of his colleagues, especially in the exile community, who that I forgot to say that they not feeling very good about Geneva, they moved to New York and they affiliated with Columbia University. So during the war, their headquarters were on 117th Street in Manhattan. And Marcuse wrote a lot of articles for their journal, the Zeitschrift, I think it was called. And it became clear that he hoped for a democratic transformation as it became clear that the fascists were going to lose the war, that there was of course an alliance between left and right in those years, and an alliance between the U.S. and the Soviets, and tremendous hopes that from the ashes of fascism, or as the communists used to say, after Hitler, us, that there would be the makings, the resources for a radical transformation of capitalism, if not the abolition of capitalism. And for Horkheimer, the leader of the Institute, and for Adorno, his closest ally in the Institute and his co-author on the Dialectic of Enlightenment, these hopes were not very compelling, and they were much more interested in how the whole arc of revolutionism and radicalism and liberalism had within it the seeds of an authoritarian culture, and they had very little hope that anything could be done about this, which informed their response to the New Left when that came along some years later.
And how did Marcuse see that? Obviously, he lived through both the dark years of fascism, but also of the Moscow trials and an awareness of the crimes that were being committed in the Soviet Union. And yet he also held on to hopes of revolution. How did he see this?
Well, he went to work for the government as it became clear that he was not so much in tune with the Institute, although in the book, I got this very much from Marcuse's son, Peter, who was very helpful to me in putting this together. The break with the Institute came when they briefly shuttled off to California, basically because Horkheimer needed to be out of the Northeast for his health. And Horkheimer and Pollack, who was the administrative head of the Institute, cut Marcuse's pay and did everything they could to get him to back off of what they were doing. And at the same time, a lot of the emigre intellectuals were being offered work in government, analyzing the politics and the culture of Central Europe and of Germany in particular. And so I think it was very important in Marcuse's thinking that he went from Santa Monica to Washington, D.C. and helped the anti-fascist material cause, that is, the Allied side on the war. That was the parting of the ways, and that was when he became interested in taking a very close look at the Soviet Union and at how fascism had transformed Germany.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly. I'm speaking today with the author and illustrator of the graphic biography Herbert Marcuse, Philosopher of Utopia. That's published by City Lights Books, and you can find a link to it on againstthegrain.org. Nick Torkelson is a Boston-based cartoonist, and his other books include The Comic Strip of Neoliberalism. So after the Frankfurt School, in effect, relocates, as you mentioned, to the U.S. during the war, of course, people like Walter Benjamin do not make it across, but quite a few German immigrants do make it to the United States, including Bertolt Brecht and others. After the war, the Frankfurt School relocates itself back to Germany. And as you've mentioned, Marcuse is not part of that. And there's an inward turn that much of the intellectual left takes in the post-war years. Tell us about that turn and how Marcuse understood it.
The 50s, Marcuse wrote the first of his two masterpieces called Eros and Civilization, and he's I think the subtitle is something like A Philosophical Encounter with Freud. So the title Eros and Civilization is a takeoff on Freud's pessimistic book Civilization and Its Discontents. And what Marcuse was very fascinated by Freud and spoke from then on in Freudian terms about aggression and instinct and eros and thanatos and these Freudian terms and concepts. And he wanted to do a friendly critique of Freud's thought on the grounds that he felt that Freud, like his former colleagues in the Institute, had a brilliant critique, but did not see a way out. And Marcuse felt that there had to be a way out, that it was unacceptable to despair of civilization being fundamentally repressive or nothing or not civilization at all. Marcuse could not accept that idea. And that was why he wrote this book talking about Eros, which is simply Cupid, you know, the in Freudian terminology, the life instinct, the instinct to live. And talking about that in sexual terms and in social terms as a force to be reckoned with and a force to pay, to respect, to give it its entire due and not say that it must submit in order for us to get along with each other. So that's the germ of the idea of Eros and Civilization. It's a fascinating book. It's my favorite of his books to the extent that I understand them.
So in that work, he grapples with the idea and something that obviously Freud does not, about the working day, about leisure. How did he understand the need to reduce the working day as part of this liberatory opening that could happen under other circumstances?
Yes, I think it's in that book that he develops what became his major and his very most encouraging idea, which is that we have surplus repression in what we're now calling late capitalism. Somebody said it's never late enough, but that's what we call it. And that was very exciting to me as I grappled with that book to realize that he was talking about a very practical matter, that people, in spite of these astonishing productivity gains, are still working much too hard and working in ways that are life are deadening and miserable, and that these productivity gains should go towards creating a better life for all of us instead of just creating more products for us to buy so that there will be more jobs for people that they hate. And he says in that book, the reduction of the working day is absolutely essential to any idea of freedom coming out of the Industrial Revolution, freedom coming out of the productivity gains of modern society. And God knows that we still need that idea and we still need to do something about it, because it hasn't really gotten a whole lot better since he wrote those words.
When he wrote his book and it was published, The One-Dimensional Man, he catapulted into a position of being one of the celebrity philosopher of the New Left. Tell us about the argument that he makes in The One-Dimensional Man, which builds on the arguments of Eros and Civilization, and how it ended up reaching this mass audience. Obviously, something was happening in the United States at the time.
I think it's safe to say that he had the attention of feminists before One Dimensional Man came out. But yes, One Dimensional Man made him a rock star of philosophy, which sounds like a contradiction in terms, but it's not an exaggeration. He was one of those intellectuals who could not get a ticket to one of his talks. They were so popular, and everybody was talking about him. And the critique of consumerism was a big part of that. What he tries to get at in One Dimensional Man is a combination of what the what the Frankfurt School was famous for, talking about the how you blunt the rebel urge, how you get people to lose their instinct for happiness and their instinct for a good life and sublimate it, into acquisition. And he coined the phrase, I don't think I used it in the book, but repressive desublimation. He also piles onto the idea of sublimating Eros and talks about how modern society, and this is in the era of Hugh Hefner and the Playboy clubs and the lifting of censorship of sexual material with Lady Chatterley's Lover and Henry Miller. Repressive desublimation is how you make room for the erotic at the expense of Eros. And this also dovetails with the feminist critique, I think. And so for people who were getting woke, as we say, by the civil rights movement and by the women's movement later on, and particularly by the Vietnam War, this was a way of thinking about how could a society that was supposedly democratic and freedom-loving support these oppressions and these atrocities.
One thing I guess one could say about Marcuse is that his was a life not only of all these rich ideas, but obviously of also kind of academic precarity. And having been forced to emigrate, booted out of the Frankfurt School, and he found himself, I guess, at the time, maybe not surprisingly, as he drew all of this interest and all of the support from the emerging new left and feminist movement, he also drew the ire of the right, notably John Wayne and the KKK, but also Ronald Reagan, who was the governor of California. What was the price that he ended up paying for that interest?
Well, he had two academic posts. He was in his 50s when he got the first one at Brandeis. Both colleges that he worked at were new. Brandeis was launched after World War II. And the University of California San Diego campus was brand new when he got there towards the end of the 60s. And in both places, his writings got him into trouble. He went up against the pioneering president of Brandeis, Abram Secker, who could not understand why the students were he of course was happy that students were flocking to Brandeis in order to study with Marcuse, but he was not happy that the donors were looking at this guy who was anti-capitalist on the staff of the university. And you have to remember that in the early 60s was a continuation of the 50s. It was still a very conservative time, and Marxism was off the table. Socialism was off the table. There was not much room for people who believed in that sort of thing. So Sekar was having some trouble with fundraising, although he was not having much trouble with recruiting students because of Marcuse, and turned against him and forced him out. And then, of course, in the years of his greatest fame, when he was at San Diego, as you mentioned, Ronald Reagan singled him out by name as an enemy of the people, as somebody who could not possibly be allowed to teach in a state university. And Spiro Agnew, Nixon's vice president, also attacked him by name. And in the course of Agnew's attack on Marcuse, he said the Agnews and I think it's fair to say the right wing idea of higher education is that it's vocational education. It's wrong to ask people to look too deeply into things. Just teach them how to build an airplane or a wind tunnel and goodbye and good luck was Agnew's idea of what colleges should be doing. So that would have all been one thing, but then the newspapers got a hold of it, and San Diego was a very conservative city, a militarized city. And when they heard that students in Europe were shouting MMM when Marcuse spoke, meaning Mao, Marx, Marcuse, they said, how can this be? How can this be that this new university in our midst has somebody whose name is associated with Karl Marx? And all of the extreme right, the Klan and the Minutemen, threatened him and attacked him. There was an armed attack on his home that caused him and his second wife Inga to go into hiding. So it was serious. It was very serious. And Lowell Bergman, who I knew as an undergraduate in Madison, who went on to study with Marcuse, told me about how the grad students would walk him from the campus to his home armed in case of an incident. That's how bad it was.
Well, one of the things that drew attention to Marcuse and fed into the media's fixation on his ideas was his support of the idea of revolution. And I wanted to ask you, what did revolution mean to him, and how did it relate to this thread of an impulse towards utopia?
Well, that's a tough question and a very good one. I think Marcuse was no more than Karl Marx willing to speculate about exactly what a revolution would mean, although he spoke very concretely, as I said, of shortening the workday and all sorts of concrete things that could be done that would lead in the direction of his idea of a good life. But he did not concern himself with strategy and tactics, as far as I know, beyond supporting certain concrete things like that. And for him, the closest he comes to laying out what he means by revolution and what he means by liberation, and liberation is in the title of one of his books, is in Eros and Civilization and An Essay on Liberation, that short book that he did after One Dimensional Man, to where he says that the idea of liberation and revolution is to allow the whole human being to be at play and to have power and to have consciousness and fellowship with others. But I think it's, if you wanted to look for a criticism of Marcuse, you could say that his description of that good life was not very detailed. He just believed, and this is his subjectivity, which is the origin of all of his thought, the importance of the subjective, is that he needed more than this society was giving him, and he saw that others were in the same situation. And that's what he called oppression, and it included the oppression of the poor, and he constantly expressed his debt to Angela Davis for teaching him about what extreme oppression means in American society and in Western society. But I think it also meant for him that thwarting, that feeling that his whole being, or the whole being of people who long for a satisfactory life, was not paid attention to and did not have scope.
I'm speaking with Boston-based cartoonist Nick Torkelson about the book which he illustrated and wrote, which is a graphic biography of Herbert Marcuse, Philosopher of Utopia. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So Marcuse found a massive audience with the New Left, and he was supportive of the movements of the New Left, including the events in Paris in May 1968. And yet his earlier collaborators, who he stayed in touch with in the Frankfurt School, Adorno, Theodore Adorno in particular, ended up as a critic of the New Left and also in some ways the recipient of the ire of the New Left. How would you contrast their differing perspectives on the New Left and the debate they had between each other about it?
Well, in the book, I try to tie that difference to water. I have the Frankfurt School arriving in California that first time and saying, there's the Pacific Ocean, why don't we send out a message in the bottle, which I can't remember the German version of that of that image, but it's a very strong image in German culture, I guess. And somebody says, yeah, we should put a message in the bottle. And somebody else says, yeah, it should say, I feel so lousy. And there was, and this is the beginning of the break between Marcuse and his colleagues in the Institute, that they found the popular culture that had its headquarters in Los Angeles and in Southern California perfectly hideous. And Marcuse was much more ambivalent. He liked the water. And his colleagues, Adorno and Horkheimer, had a much more totalizing critique of mass culture than Marcuse did, I would say. And they were revolted by the life in America, and they couldn't wait to get back to Germany after the war was over. And Marcuse stayed. He did not find it repulsive. It seems to me, a much more easygoing and humorous and receptive soul than they were. And Joe Sacco, my hero in nonfiction cartooning, who I was in touch with about the book, said his only objection to the book was that I was too hard on Adorno, and I readily admit that I am not a big student of Adorno and a big reader of Adorno, and I'm don't want to take too much away from him since I am not an expert on that subject, but I think that's where the difference lies, that Marcuse was open, and he was open to the new left, and Adorno was not. Adorno, when he saw posters making fun of him, he sued the people that were responsible for them. When he saw people occupying the offices of the Frankfurt School, he called the police, and that was the beginning of the final debate, the correspondence that I give a lot of quotes from in the comic, between Adorno and Marcuse right before Adorno died, where Adorno is saying, these are barbarians, these new leftists, and Marcuse is saying, but they are fighting the war in Vietnam, and Adorno is saying, well, if you're going to criticize the U.S. in Vietnam, you should criticize the National Liberation Front in Vietnam, because they're barbarians, and that was a pretty intense difference between these former fellow revolutionaries, that the ones in Germany were saying were not receptive to the anti-war movement and to the anti-imperialist view of the world, and Marcuse was, and that was a big part of Marcuse's popularity. There were plenty of social critics in academia when I came of age in the 1960s, and some of them were sympathetic to the ideas of the new left, and very few of them would support the militants and the actual actions of the new left. But Marcuse was open to all of that.
And yet he was not without his criticisms of the new left and the counterculture.
Yes.
And it's interesting to read at a time when certainly the more militants of the new left were seeing revolution as around the corner, that Marcuse, who had kept the flame of revolution burning throughout his life, did not see that to be the case.
Yes, Marcuse said in an interview, which I reproduce almost entirely in the comic, was asked, do you see the new left as revolutionary? He said, no. And he had a right to say that, because he had been in an authentic revolution. And he said, you can't have a revolution without the working class, and this is a student movement, so you should not be thinking of it as revolutionary. So he was alternately amused and critical of, or both at the same time, I guess, the what he, I believe, referred to as the megalomania of the new left, that they saw themselves as being capable of more than they were capable of. And that word megalomaniac or megalomania I got from George Katsifikas, who was one of his students in San Diego, and who lived where I live in Boston for during his academic career. And he mentioned to me that he was working on an underground paper, and they talked about Nelson Rockefeller more or less quaking in his boots, because there was an anti-CIA coalition at the University of California, San Diego, and being Nelson Rockefeller being relieved that this group had disbanded. And Marcuse said, really? I don't think so. So there was that criticism of the megalomania. He was not crazy about rock and roll. He was his tastes were very highbrow, but he said some nice things about jazz, which Adorno famously couldn't bear jazz and was disgusted by the intelligentsia embracing jazz as a legitimate art form. He could not see it at all. He said it's the music of slaves. It is not the music of people who can rise up, and that sort of thing. And Marcuse was more Catholic in his tastes, small c Catholic in his tastes.
Let me end by asking you about Marcuse's relevance in our times today. I'm presuming you think that he is relevant in that you went through the trouble of creating a graphic biography which makes the life and ideas and times, changing times of Marcuse, highly accessible. What's the relevance of Marcuse today? Why should we familiarize ourselves with his ideas?
Well, when I talk about that in my lengthy elevator speech, that is to say what I've been doing on this tour in bookstores, what I try to emphasize is that Marcuse always kept before him not simply the resistance to oppression, but the striving towards pleasure, towards a life where pleasure is possible, where real pleasure is possible. And I think the relevance of that is that even though the reappearance of semi-fascistic ideas in American politics and in American government has brought a lot of people to the left and to some comfortability with the idea of socialism and truly radical transformation, it also makes people a little afraid to think about what they really want, because what they want first is to overcome this fascistic tendency in not just the United States, but now we see it in Hungary and Brazil and so on. And so I think when we started this project, it was pre-Trump, and I was looking at those ideas and that simultaneous critique and affirmation as totally consistent with the Occupy moment, which was clearly a utopian moment and a movement towards that was full of ideas about how life should be. And as the wheel turned and we had this extremely authoritarian and fascistic or neo-fascistic bent, that kind of dreaming, that kind of utopianism becomes dicey, and I think people are afraid to embrace it. And what I think Marcuse teaches us is you must never forget what you want, that you are, if you engage politically, you are not just resisting oppression, you're not just resisting authoritarianism, you're not just fighting to protect your friends and neighbors, which is absolutely crucial, but you are also trying to build a good life.
Nick Torkelson, thank you so much.
And I really want to thank you, Sasha. This was a great interview.
I've been speaking with the author and illustrator of the graphic biography, Herbert Marcuse, Philosophy of Utopia, published by City Lights Books and onagainstthegrain.org. You can find a link to the book. He's a Boston-based cartoonist. His other books include The Comic Strip of Neoliberalism. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.